Hello, everyone, and welcome back to another episode of the TetraCast. This is RPG Site's weekly podcast where we get the site staff together to talk about our favorite genre of video games. My name is Brian Vitale. Joining me today, we have Josh Torres.
Holy hell, what a crazy week.
And we have Chow Min Wu.
You sure about that?
It's been a crazy week. So I'm back on the TetraCast. So obviously anyone who is a regular listener, I've been out the last couple of weeks just on a personal vacation. So obviously thanks to Josh and Chow here as well as Adam and James. Was James here last week?
Yeah.
Okay. He's not here this week because obviously there's been a lot of events going
James
on this
was not
week.
Here last
actually,
week.
Actually, I'm kidding. Yeah, James wasn't here last week. That was 2 weeks ago. Yes.
Okay. No, he wasn't here. Yeah. So I wasn't here. James wasn't here. James is in Tokyo for TGS. Obviously, we have a lot of news coming out of TGS. We also had a State of Play. Level 5 finally had their Vision event that had been postponed from earlier in the year. We have a couple games releasing at the end of September. We have a lot of games slated for October. So, of course, it's a busy week. Adam is also out for a couple weeks for a personal family visit. So it'll be us three holding down the fort. Obviously, we've had a lot of people on staff covering the news out of TGS, none doing more heavy lifting than Josh here. So, Josh, thank you so much for upending your sleep schedule to follow all the publishers, all the streams, all the live events going on out of TGS and synthesizing all that data and getting it up on the site and transferring it up to the rest of us.
Honestly, it's like not as bad as previous years, which is like good and bad, I guess. Like I've heard from like multiple people, acquaintances, friends, like whatever, that's like, it's definitely, it feels like it's more business, big business focused than like other TGS events, or like there's like smaller events for like more niche developers and publishers and stuff like that. So it's like good and bad in the sense that like the amount of news isn't like as crazy, but at the same time, like it feels like there's just like less games to see in a way.
And a lot of the framing of the news, we see this kind of at the summer events too. Different developers or publishers will try to preempt the deluge by kind of announcing a major headline early. Like for instance, we got just recently the release date for the Suikoden remaster, and then it again did show up at TGS. But since they had already shown the release date, what they focused on in the TGS stream was just comparing the original and the remaster for UI, for sound elements, things like that, which is still neat. It was just kind of part of a collection of other updates for games that had already been kind of detailed elsewhere. It's the usual thing that we see where the games will kind of show up and crop up in different presentation formats, and then it's our job to kind of synthesize it together and say, well, here's what came out of TGS. So we're recording this during the last day of TGS over in Japan because we're recording this on Saturday.
I think it's two public days, right? So the first public day just ended, and I think the tonight, which is going to be the second day of TGS, public day of TGS. I think that's the last day? Question mark. I think it's like two business days and two public days.
That's what I meant. So like we're recording this on Saturday in the West, which is Sunday morning in Japan, and Sunday is the last TGS public day. So I think we've got all the major news out of there. Obviously we'll wrap back up next week if there's anything that's lingering. But one of the games we're going to be talking about in our first section here is the release of late September. And that's of course the new Zelda title, Zelda Echoes of Wisdom. So I've been playing this, just not a review code, not responsible for that, but just purchasing it and playing it on my own. We do have a review up on the site from Alex Donaldson. So go ahead and give that a read. But I was just, I gave it a read just to kind of compare my experience with his. But I was just going to open up the podcast just talking about my time with that before we go into news. And we also do have one Japanese release. We'll talk a little bit about Kai no Kiseki, which recently released in Japan. Of course, this is the most recent release in the Trail series following Kuro 1 and 2 or Daybreak 1 and 2. Obviously, with no announced plans for the West, we have Daybreak 2 coming out early 2025. We'll talk about that in a very brief session after we talk about Zelda. Of course, any discussion about Kai, we'll state it clearly up front. We will not be going into any story spoilers for that game. But I'll open up here with Zelda. I'm not completed with it yet, but I'm about 15 hours in. I believe there's roughly 8 dungeons, and I've finished 6 of them, so that's kind of where I'm at. I've explored the whole map, but I'm kind of finishing up heart pieces and side quests and things like that. And I actually don't think that any discussion here will take too long, mainly because of how this game is presented. Obviously, it's the first original, I hope I'm not forgetting anything here, it's the first original top-down Zelda game since A Link Between Worlds. I believe I have that right. Of course, we had the Link's Awakening remaster. When did that release? Time goes by so fast now.
I forgot the remake. Yeah.
Six years ago, something like that. Right before the pandemic. Yeah. Yeah.
Also, I say it's like the first game starting Princess Zelda. And it's like since the CDI era or something like that.
Well, yeah, it's not the first, but it's in few and far between.
Yeah. But random tangent. Did you know that there was like I forget the name of the game, but there's like an indie title that is deliberately trying to like make a spiritual successor to the CDI Zelda games. They got back like the original artists and voice actors.
Is that called like Arzet or something? I forgot.
Yes.
What it's called.
Yeah. 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 Have we covered that? I don't remember, but yeah, there are.
I've seen it. I think it already, I don't know if it's released already, but
Arzet, awesome. The Jewel of Faramore. Oh, it did release earlier this year. But yeah. Anyways. But yeah, this is obviously the main thing here is that it's got the, for talking again about Zelda Echoes of Wisdom, it's got that toy box art style that was debuted with the Link's Awakening remake, which I think is a very pretty art style. It's just unique and something different. And it is the first game in a while that stars Zelda. It's got the classic 2D Zelda dungeon overworld playground style, I guess, in progression style, in terms of not being the open world sandbox that Breath of the Wild and Tears of the Kingdom is. And the reason why I don't think it'll take a long time to discuss this game is because even though it does shake things up in terms of the echo mechanic, in terms of starring Zelda, in terms of the other kind of gameplay wrinkles that are in there, playing this game is very nostalgic in a good way. It feels like a game that I could have played 10 years ago. But I'm not. I don't mean that with any disparaging. It's comfort food in that sense. Where if you have played and liked any 2D Zelda game at all, or Oracle games, Minish Cap, any of them, you will like something here because it feels very return to form in that sense. It's not going to like upend the convention there. It feels very nostalgic and it almost feels like a game you've played before, even if you haven't. And I kind of appreciate that because, of course, with Breath of the Wild and Tears of the Kingdom, we hear to different extents, but primarily in agreement that those games have a lot to enjoy about them, but they are different in terms of dungeon design, in terms of progression, in terms of linearity, where this one does incorporate a few of those concepts into its DNA, Echoes of Wisdom, but it's more of a classic formula there. So if you've missed old school Zelda dungeons, Breath of the Wild really didn't have them at all. Tears of the Kingdom kind of went a step further, but it still really didn't compare by the time all was said and done. This one is a little bit more true to form. It does introduce a little bit more non-linearity to it, but more in the sense of you can do dungeons 2 and 3 in any order. You can do dungeons after the Zelda games almost always have a mid-game event where you become an adult in Ocarina of Time, or you access the Dark World, A Link to the Past, or whatever. This game has a very similar cadence where you do some initial dungeons, then a story event happens, and then the world's your oyster, and you have a bunch of dungeons you can do at that time in any order. So it's a little bit more nonlinear in that sense, but it's not the sandbox that the two Switch console games are. One thing that I was hoping would be better in Echoes of Wisdom is that if you've played Link's Awakening Remake, this one still has this very similar level of performance. It doesn't run very well on the Switch. It'd be probably a very good game on Switch too, presuming there's backward compatibility and a performance boost on it. But it's if you played Link's Awakening Remake and you know how that performed, this game is very similar. It's just
that's
how it
shame.
Is.
Yeah, that's my fear. It's like, oh, okay, the first thing I thought. Like, okay, they're doing the Link's Awakening Remake style. How's the performance? And it's about, you know, as expected, I guess.
Yeah, and it also has this like vignetting effect where the bottom and top of the screen is slightly blurred.
It's like the first Octopath.
Yeah, and it's one of those things where like I think that sort of artistry could look good. I mean, there's some people, and this is a valid opinion to have, that they don't want any blurring. They want any depth of field, any bokeh, any all of that off.
That's me. I turn off motion blur and I turn off depth of field. Anytime there are options,
I almost always turn them off because my opinion is that if they're implemented well, you barely even notice. You should not notice. Where here, yeah. It is very blatant. It's obvious. If anything's in the foreground, it's a blurry mess. I don't know why I'm just kind of rambling. I just wanted to talk about this game, and that's the I feel pretty positively about this game, and now here I am, like, by the way, it performs poorly. It has a lot.
Those are the cons, you know. You talk the good and the bad.
Hey, you're just being honest, you know. Like, sometimes you gotta mention these things, you know.
Yeah. Talking about the game a little bit more critically, I suppose one of the things that Alex brought up in his review, he did bring it up. He did think pretty favorably on it, but like the thesis of his written review is kind of like, yeah, this game stars Zelda. Yeah, this game has some different mechanics, but there really isn't a lot in this game's DNA that reminds you that you are Zelda. Like it just as easily could have been Link. And then the way the game progresses is obviously shown in a lot of the trailers is that you can access like the sword fighter form, where normally Zelda cannot access a sword and a shield, but has to use the Echoes mechanic, which I actually really kind of enjoy because it just changes the pace of combat. Like in a normal 2D Zelda game, you're running across the field, you see two moblins. Okay, if you have enough health, you just go and fight them. Where here, the pacing's a little bit different. You're like, okay, what echo do I want to use? You might just be more inclined to ignore them because there's a little bit more of a ramp up in terms of selecting an echo, spawning whatever you like, positioning yourself because Zelda can't jump very high, etc. It's just the pace is just different. But as you go throughout the game and you progress, you get items, you get different, obviously you get heart pieces, you extend how often you can transition into the sword fighter form. And it almost feels like the stronger you get, the less you have to use the bespoke mechanics, the more you just toggle into sword fighter form and play the game more conventionally, which I'm kind of up two minds about. It's kind of nice because it's like, okay, I don't need to ramp up and use echoes. I can just fight them. But then you're also kind of diluting, okay, then I'm just playing this game more traditionally. And I don't think I've sat on the game long enough to know on what side of that fence I fall. I'm just kind of noticing it where it's like the further I get in this game, the less I have to play this differently from any other Zelda game, which is fine because the Zelda games I enjoy, I've enjoyed a lot of them, but it just feels like it could have been done differently. That's kind of where I'm sitting at that right now, again, like 3/4 of the way through it. There's lots of mini games to do, like horse races. There's a mini game where you have to use the traversal skills to pick up. In the Link's Awakening remake, there's acorns. I believe they're acorns that you find scattered throughout the world to power yourself up. Oh wait, they're seashells. In this game, there's kind of a magic crystal that you use to power up your sword fighter form. And they're like under rocks or in shrubs or in caves or behind boulders and things like that. So that's kind of like your motivation to explore. And eventually, just like in Link's Awakening remake, you eventually get like a radar that can like detect where those are at. It's got that very conventional sort of collectathon aspect to it. There's not a traditional trading sequence as far as I can tell, which is kind of a bummer because I kind of always look forward to those. But there are a few like bespoke rewards where if you do the races at the Hyrule Ranch, it's not called Lon Lon Ranch, it's called Hyrule Ranch in this one, you'll get a music box, which eventually you can trade to Dompei, who in this game does the automaton, so you use that to build a specific automaton. So it's got your usual flair of side quests, things like that. Alex did talk in his review that this game does lift a lot of the UI elements from Breath of the Wild Tears of the Kingdom in terms of your primary quest marker, what characters look like when they have a side quest to get you, your quest log UI. The UI for using your echoes is very similar to the UI for using the sword, shield, and bows from the console games. And I kind of actually like that. Even though the game looks very different and plays very different, it does give it a little bit of connective tissue between the 2D and the console games. One thing that disappoints me a little bit is the side quests in this game, at least early on in the first like 10, 12 hours, a lot of it is very much, I want to see this echo. Can you show me this? Like, I want to see a keys that is on fire. And then if you've seen a fire keys, fire bat, you summon it and they're like, wow, thank you for showing me that. Here are 10 rupees or whatever. And the thing is that makes sense for like introductory side quests, but they don't really get any more interesting or rewarding than that until quite a bit later in the game. Like now I'm just now like seeing that sort of stuff. So it's one of those things where I think a little bit more could have been done there, but it's, you know, they're distractions. If you don't want to do them, you don't have to, they're optional. The main quest is pretty like, people don't play Zelda games. At least I don't play Zelda games for the main story. It's charming enough. It's interesting enough. Some of the characters are kind of fun. You get some Gorons that are named like General Silver and General Gold because they like eat rocks and minerals, things like that.
Yeah.
There's in Hyrule Castle, there's like a captain left and a minister right. And they play off each other pretty fun. But it's more character moments and things like that rather than arc or narrative. So like talking about this game, there's really not much to spoil. It's a lot of kind of the same flavor. Like, oh, there's a Goron city. Oh, there's a Zora city. They've already kind of shown that they do this fun interaction between the river and the lake Zoras, things like that. I will say that one of the dungeons does have a returning boss that I wasn't expecting to see that I don't think has shown up since their original debut. So I won't say who that is, but that's pretty fun. And then as for the dungeons themselves, they are, I'm very glad to see a return to form in terms of having multiple levels, small keys. You get a dungeon map and there's optional rooms that you have to kind of think outside the box to get into. And usually those reward with like rupees or materials that you don't have to get to clear the dungeon, but they're extra. But I don't think I think they're kind of middle of the pack in terms of 2D Zelda dungeons. There's a lot of dungeons where you're never really expected to backtrack. You go into each room once, you do a small puzzle, and then you never have to go back. And I kind of like, you know, in my opinion, the best Zelda dungeons, you should go to a room that has two locked doors and you have one key and have to decide which to unlock. So you are necessarily forced to like backtrack at some point. But in a lot of the dungeons, at least within the first six, even like the most recent dungeon I did later in the game, they're very linear in the sense that it's not a straight line, but you go in each room once, you get the treasure there, and then you never have to repeat it. So a lot of the dungeons are very straightforward. So they're still kind of better than the ones that are in the console games, but I think the game has done, like Oracle of Ages, I believe, I think are my high watermark for dungeons in the 2D Zelda games. I think Minish Cap has some really good ones as well. It's good to see them back, but they're not in the top three. But I still like them. It's still nice to revisit them. It's nostalgic in that way.
It's more like because the recent Zelda entries have really shied away from the dungeon aspect. And it's just like, it's one of those, it's like, oh, it's good to be back. That like, there's still like dungeons are still relevant in the Zelda, in these mainline Zelda series, you know, because Breath of the Wild and Tears of the Kingdom shied away from them. And that was kind of like, even though they're still excellent games, that was definitely a sore point for, like, you know, traditional Zelda fan. Mm-hmm. Like, you know, the shrines really aren't dungeons.
It's a little bit kind of like in Skyward Sword, the main thing that game was, like, advertised is, like, well, the whole world is a dungeon. Like, even getting to the dungeon, you had to do dungeon-like things. And, of course, that's a 3D Zelda, so it's not a true comparison. This game has a little bit of that. Like, usually you'll have to do some platforming, some combat, some lock-and-key puzzles, even before you get to the dungeon. So I want to take credit for that a little bit. Obviously, there is a little bit of a puzzle aspect to it for, like, which echoes you happen to find. And echoes are not really hidden. And whether they're objects or monsters, they glow yellow. And every single time you defeat a monster that you don't have the echo for, it'll, like, shrink into a miniature size of itself. Once you defeat it, you go up to it and you pick it up. But there are some echoes that are way, way more useful than others. For instance, this is not really a spoiler. It's just a very, very useful echo that if you get this, it will trivialize a lot of the movement, like based platforming in the game, is that you'll go into like one of those 2D rooms where you go down a ladder. Instead of having the top down view, you have a left right view. Very like Link's Awakening did this, Oracle Games did this, very, very traditional. And you'll have they're not called thwomps, but you'll have the platforms that if you go under them, they'll try to crush you. I forget what they're called in this game. They're called like platform dons or something like that. And then as soon as they try to crush you, you can defeat it and pick it up as an echo. And then when you summon it, it will just like elevator platform you up pretty damn high, up cliffs, up rock faces. Like in some of the trailers, they showed Zelda linking to like a crawling spider and doing the reverse bond and going up a cliff. Where once I got this platform, which you can get pretty early, like before the second dungeon, or maybe after the second dungeon, around the second dungeon, you just summon this elevator platform and it trivializes almost all locomotion in the game. It's nice to have. It makes a lot of the mini games a lot easier. It makes you able to access areas, I won't say sequence breaking, but earlier than you think you would normally be able to intend to. But it does kind of mean like, I'm just going to use this echo 1,000 times where every other echo might be doing something interesting, but they're far less useful, so I barely summon them.
Yeah.
And there's also come sort of things where, like, I almost feel like there's too many echoes where like you get a, like one of the things they show is you get a basic bed, and the basic bed actually is a very useful echo. I still use it a lot, even 15 hours in, but you also get like, you can visit Zelda's room in the castle and get Zelda's bed. And it costs more to summon. And the only difference I believe is that if you rest in it, it heals you faster. But when I'm summoning beds, I'm not using them to heal me. I'm using them as platforms. So I'm just like, I'm never going to summon this bed. I'm just going to keep summoning the basic bed because it's cheaper. And if I ever need a heal, I'm just going to use a potion or a fairy or something. So they're not, and I'm not saying every echo has to be equally useful. I just think it might have been more cool to have like 30 very interesting, very distinct echoes rather than, I don't know what the total is, 70, but 40 of them are mostly useless sort of thing. That's kind of where I'm at right now. But of course, I'm trying to keep an open mind. I might watch a video later and they're like, by the way, did you know you could combine these two echoes to do this thing? And I'm like, oh, I never thought of that. So I'm keeping an open mind. There's something that I'm sure there are a number of echoes that I thought were useless, and then I just haven't utilized them in the most useful way yet. But yeah, my opinions on Echoes of Wisdom do align pretty similarly with Alex, the written review up on the site. It doesn't seem like it's a super long game. It's about, I've heard people who have played it, some people, of course, have played it early, 20 to 25 hours if you're pretty completionist about it. So it's, and of course, if you mainlined it, I'm sure you could go a bit quicker. So a little bit longer than Link's Awakening, about the same length as a lot of the other later stage 2D Zelda games. Very, very nostalgic, very comfort food. If you don't like 2D Zelda games, you won't like this. If you do like 2D Zelda games, you will like this. If you haven't played a Zelda game, the main difference here is that it's a lot more guided and straightforward than the console games, with a little bit more focus on dungeon. But I think this game is still a little bit more focused on just like the flavor of the world rather than being a pure, I would still go back to like Oracle or Minish Cap for like the true 2D dungeon experience, or go back to Link to the Past, obviously a classic there. But very good game. Not going to surprise you in any real ways. I wish it did a little bit more with the Zelda mechanic, but it doesn't do bad. It just does pretty well.
Yeah. These are pretty fair assessments of it. You know, I think it's just like, I'm interested to see what people find, like in terms of like how flexible the ecosystem really is, because it's, you know, I'm sure people will find a lot of fucked up ways to really utilize echoes, like you said earlier. Like, I'm just, you know, don't ever underestimate human creativity.
Yeah, it's not on the same level as Tears of the Kingdom. We're not going to see like Gundams going or like catapults slinging Koroks across the field. But there's a little bit of room for inventiveness here. I think it pulls just enough from the crafting system and the not the true like Ultra Hand systems from Tears of the Kingdom, but similar ish stuff with the echo and the bonding, that it's pared down significantly, but it's fun, it's cozy, it'll be a fun game to like gift newer Zelda players, younger Zelda players, and people who have the nostalgia for it. I think it's a game that they'll enjoy plenty. It's a good game. We were looking at some other things to talk about this week. Obviously, we have a lot of games coming out in the early October timeframe that have released demos, Romantic Saga 2, Metaphor. But you know, Metaphor is coming out in 2 weeks. Romantic Saga 2 is coming out in, let me check here,
like October
24th. Mid-October, so like 3.5 weeks. So we'll talk about those games in full once they release, rather than talking about the demo and then turning around within a couple weeks and talking about the full release. But obviously those demos are out. We do have people in our Discord channel that have been playing through those. I've seen a lot of differing takes on the Metaphor demo. So a lot of people are playing through that. That seems to be pretty substantial. And it's a few weeks old at this point, but a lot of people have been really excited about the Romancing Saga 2 demo. But we're going to talk about Kaino Kiseki, which obviously just released in Japan. This is the newest entry in the Kiseki series. It's the third game in the Kuro sub-series. You can think of it in that way. But we're not going to spoil anything here. But we do have a few people on staff, including Josh, who have been following the release of Kai no Kiseki. So because we don't know when we're going to see it in English, and we have a few months before we go through Daybreak 2's official English release, you had mentioned that you just wanted to chat kind of briefly about Kai no Kiseki in terms of its release, not in terms of course anything involving the story or spoilers in that case, but just in terms of its placement within the series overall.
Yeah, I mean, like, yeah, we'll definitely talk about the premise of it. I think it's hard to talk about the game without even like establishing what it's about. And you know, Chao has been checking it out too. So like you said, there's the Legend of Heroes Kai no Kiseki, and then the subtitle for it is Farewell O Zamuria. This follows after several months after The events of Trails Through Daybreak 2, which will release in the West sometime in early 2025. This is an interesting game because this is structured in a lot in the way of like Hajimari no Kiseki or Trails Into Reverie and so forth, where you kind of have a separate parties, a route selection type of structure to this game, much like Reverie.
It takes a while to get there. I still haven't even unlocked the route selection yet.
It's not like it doesn't open up right away because it does a lot of like build. It ramps up to it. Let's say, and there's still very much like Vaughn is still the main protagonist. Vaughn Arkwright is like the protagonist of the Calvard arc, and he's still firmly the main character in this game, even though he's sharing that main character role like through different routes. He still has like the most substantial arc and route to this game so like going into this game I was like I play this along with my friend because me and him interpret the game for other people in a Discord for other people who are tuning in and we're both fairly knowledgeable on what's going on and what's being said in it, and we're very admittedly pretty down on like how Trails Through Daybreak 2 was handled. I won't say why. I mean, you know, people can make their, you know, form their own opinions for themselves if they've yet to play it, and especially when it comes gets a Western release. But me and him were pretty unified on like we didn't have a high opinion of it, but I'll keep it at that.
Well, so, I'm probably in the same boat. I think a lot of people get filtered from the last part of the game because the pacing just went down the drain.
I won't get into why.
So
the premise of Kaina Kiseki is that there's this basically this operation called Star Taker happening in the Calvard region, and it's basically their the big initiative to launch into space pretty much. And the whole thing is like they're doing these test shuttle launches into space, and then eventually they're gonna launch like a human into space, and there's like a really really big event in that region. So, you know, due to the ongoing, like, several factors around this operation, you know, they're inviting some people are inviting, some people are sneaking into Calvard. Like, for example, Rin from the Cold Steel series makes his return in Kai no Kiseki, but, like, he's explicitly, like, you know, invited from Calvard to kind of partake into some elements around it, while other characters like Kevin from the Sky series are there on like he has his own assignment, and you know that there's a whole it gets revealed, but he has his own personal reasons for you know why he's
participating. He's part of the team.
Yeah, he's participating kind of Kiseki, not necessarily part of the team, but for his own reasons why he's there. So it's kind of an interesting structure because like the beginning of this game is like this whole unified training exercise where, yeah, like the very beginning prologue tutorial teams is kind of an interesting spread where you have like Vaughn, Ferry, and Bergard, and then the secondary party is like Rin, Altina,
and Kevin.
And then the third party is
you want to keep the third team a secret.
The third team. I'll just say right now there's gonna be some Reverie spoilers for C's route here because it's hard to kind of having to like refer to him as C. So be aware that I'm just going to be freely speak about that because it's so trying to keep C's secret at this point. Especially if it's already released in the West is kind of, it's dumb. So if you haven't played C's route in Reverie yet, you know, be aware.
Go to the next time.
The third team is Rufus, Rufus
of Reset Crow, and then there is Lapis. If you count Lapis as a teammate,
no, Reset wasn't with Rufus. There, I'm trying to remember.
Oh yeah,
Fred, you operate two teams, and then they come in, for a tutorial boss fight. So they were like the. Okay, yeah. I forgot that you don't control a third team yet.
Yeah.
So, and then
think you can actually lose the first fight. I'm not sure. I think the first fight you get like a bonus SP if you could beat them. So then it's like it's trying to teach you a tutorial about now you can kind of like the game can warn you about spamming S breaks from bosses, I guess, in a way.
I mean, that you've been able, it always warn you about incoming S breaks. Like you get the warning for sure, the alarm. But the whole there's several like new gameplay elements that they teach you here, because it still has the action turn based hybrid system. Obviously, they've been expanded upon, where the action system has other characters actually actively fighting with you pretty often in the field. So it kind of gets a bit chaotic, but they do, you know, they help you out a little. You had this new system called the ZOC, the Zoc system.
Yeah, it's like kind of slows down time.
Yeah, it slows down time. It's like especially useful for like Shining Palms, for example, where they retreat really, really, or run away really, really fast. So obviously you want to use that, the Zoc, to slow down time and hit them. You do more damage during Zoc. And it's just generally useful against like enemies that, like, you know, there's actually enemies that like aggressively like fire projectiles at you on the field now. So, and that's what that system is like, you know, that's how they teach you the system. So you can use it any way you want. It's like it's a refillable resource that like fills up over time by itself, but also you can accelerate its resource generation by just like hitting enemy.
Like both gameplay elements has been expanded a lot. So just from the action part of it, I was like, damn, this feels really fast paced. It could be even like an action game on its own, right? With how it goes, right?
Yeah. So it's not like a true combo system like DMC or something, but it's way, way faster than what like the first two Daybreak games.
And then like once you get to like the first act, then your character even has awakening, like certain characters have awakening. So for example, like Bond could go awakening. That's kind of like a double trigger, right? So normally it's supposed to be, he's supposed to transform into Grendel, but not yet. Some people like Judith has awakening because she could go into her Grimcat's form and then she can do that, and you have like insane amount of damage during like awakening, right? So you get like some of those features as well, right?
Yeah, and then like with Breen, for example, since it's his first time into the action combat role, like he can do like spirit unification through the awakening as well, and all that sort of stuff. So and that consumes like a trance resource called trance. And then the turn-based mode is interesting because they brought back sort of like the Brave Orders from the Cold Steel series.
But it costs your S-boost. And I think S-boost is like a very valuable resource in this game now compared to like the last game, because this resource is like insanely useful now. It could be used for like everything. S-breaks, shard orders, and then it's like, what about X-chain? I think you can only X-chain when you're
boosted. You have to boost to use EX-chain. So for this game, like the shard boost mechanic is back from the previous Daybreak games, but you're juggling a lot with it now. Instead of just like consuming it to just like buff an attack or like, you know, get access to S breaks, like how Daybreak 2 utilized it. Now, like you have like the Brave Order system back, so like characters in your party, even though they're not out on the field or they could be like an extra support role, like you could actually consume normally two S boosts for like a buff that lasts for a certain amount of time, like say like a defense up, and then it's good for like taking like 10 hits, for example. And it's really, really useful because a lot of enemies, especially on like the hard difficulty, like hit really, really hard. So like even like using it defensively is very valuable. And at the same time, if you're fighting against like other parties in the game, they can use their own like S boost Brave Order as well. So you can actually like overwrite and negate that by using your own S boost Brave Order against them to overwrite it at the cost of like an additional S boost meter. So there's like this whole kind of like almost a rock paper scissors mechanic of like, you know, kind of trying to outmaneuver, outflank, and strategize around like what the enemies are doing.
I think they fixed the Brave Order system, because I remember in like Cold Steel 4, it's like people just spam the Brave Order once and then they never spam it again, and you're like, okay, so what was really the point of that, really, right?
Yeah, this game also has like really, it has some good things and bad things about like the times on what they've added, like so, like for example, like debuff immunity is like a new thing in this game, so like you use debuff immunity to effectively cleanse and like the debuffs against you, but then enemies will like immediately just like, you know, strip your debuff immunity and like and hit you with debuffs again, pretty much. So like it's almost like, why did they even add like debuff immunity when they're going to be immediately stripped from us, you know? So it's like, it's weird shit like that that like they added to it. You also have like what you were talking about earlier, like that EX chain and the blitz system. Blitz system is kind of like, it sounds cool on paper. It's
but it's really, not much. It's just like people attacking from the back, sort of.
Yeah. So like when a character has a turn, sometimes they'll have like a blitz linked to like either a random character in reserve, pretty much. So like, so your character will attack or take an action, and like if they're nearby someone in battle, like in previous games, they have that person will do an action to follow up. And then, like, an extra person from reserve will also come in and do, like, a quick attack as well, pretty much. And it sounds cool on paper, because, like, at least you do something with reserve party members instead of them doing nothing. But at the same time, it's kind of like, it's whatever. It's a whatever mechanic.
But X-Chain is, I think, is the most important thing. I think a lot of the time is, like, you know how when you stun, like, enemies and stuff? And they don't really do anything. They just take a little bit more damage in previous games, right?
Yeah.
This time is like, now you can use X-Chain. I think the whole mechanic about killing bosses as soon as you can is trying to like utilize X-Chain to its perfection, because you do insane amount of damage with X-Chain.
Yeah, go explain X-Chain on how the for people who don't know.
Like, I believe that when an enemy is stunned, and then you use like an S boost, it's like there's a thing that says that, like, the next command will do a follow attack called X chain, and the X chain will be like a party member inside, and they come in and they do like extra, like, I don't know, like four times the damage that you were doing. So it's like insane, right?
Yeah, they have like the one around like cut it and shit.
Yeah, I think it does more damage than an S craft from what I did
testing. There are definitely different ways to like, you know, like abuse some of these new systems for sure. So there's a lot of flexibility on how you build certain team compositions, especially because once you unlock Grim Garden, for example, which is kind of like, you know, it's a returning mechanic from Daybreak 2. It's kind of like Reverie Corridor, but it's a little bit more involved gameplay wise, I guess.
Well, I mean, 2 it has the Marchion Garden.
Yeah, it's Marchion Garden, but I tried this because you have to realize that, like, you know, people who don't know what that is yet from Daybreak 2, so I'm trying to compare it to Reverie Corridor because they don't know what Marching Garden is yet. But that whole thing is back. It's kind of, I think that this game kind of suffers a little bit from pacing in terms of like they kind of incorporate Grim Garden too much to kind of pad out some of the content.
They're throwing a lot in. I mean, it's like the first beginning, it's kind of like an Azure type of pacing at the beginning. They're like doing like, oh, we're just doing all this questing, and it's kind of like a retread, and you're like, oh, I already know all this if you played like the past games, and like,
yeah,
they really need a recap.
It's basically like a whole extended recap intro of like reintroducing characters, you know, just in case, you know, you are for some reason starting out with this game, you know, if you're crazy enough and starting out with this game, you forgot.
I feel like they don't need that anymore. Like, I think the most important thing in this game as a lore person is the timely verse system, where you're like, oh, you could just press the left button on the D-pad, and then you get like a glossary about these terms that you might have forgotten.
Timely words, yeah. I mean, yeah, it's like the FF16 system where, like, during a conversation, you like, you know, you can bump up, you can press the D-pad to have a list of terms that are like relevant in the conversation that they're throwing out, and then you can get like, you know, explanation of like, oh, okay, what are they?
I think that's
about
a good thing for like the trail series, instead of like that random flashback and like,
dude, they fucking love the fucking random flashback. It's not like a whole flashback scene, but like,
yeah, but you can like get like a picture of like, oh, it's like I remember this town, yeah. And you see like a picture of Crow. It's like, of course I know that reference, yeah. But yeah. I don't need that, right?
It's a pretty, as a Reverie style type of game, it is a pretty heavy gated, like, you need knowledge from so many past games to like start linking things together in this game, because there's stuff from obviously you need to have, like, you know, if you want to know who Kevin is, like, you know, like his kind of whole deal, why he can do things, certain things in this game, you kind of need to play those games. There are things that happen throughout this game that make certain concepts from Zero to Owl or the Crossbell games relevant. End of Cold Steel 4 into Reverie relevant. and Daybreak 2. Like, Daybreak 2's events is, like, more involved and relevant than what you might think at first. Because, you know, a lot of people refer to Daybreak 2. And, you know, and part of it is Falcom's terminology of the way they, you know, how they talked about it post-mortem, right? But they call it, like, a quote-unquote, like, filler game, pretty much. Because of the way that, like, you, how that game is structured. And I would have been inclined to agree before this game, but the way that they kind of frame and reference and follow up on the events on that game, it's like, oh, there are definitely things about it that, like, you need to have known for certain scenes to make sense, because they're playing with some interesting concepts, in this game. So it's definitely one of those things. It's like you. It was going to be the case because, you know, a lot of people kind of started with Kuro no Kiseki or Daybreak 1 like that. Like that was, like, you know, admittedly a good quote-unquote entry point to the series.
But that kind of fell down the window.
But it's like a one-and-done thing. And I kind of stress that to the people. It's like, okay, it's like if you want to just have like a good, solid JRPG that you just like kind of like, you know, just kind of like a one-and-done thing, like, Daybreak 1 is totally fine for that. That's kind of like the strength of that game. It's like you're introduced to a new region, a new cast. You don't really need to know much of past events to like appreciate and understand the story and enjoy these characters. Pretty much, obviously, there are things in it that like they'll reference to, but you won't really need to know. Like if when Ren says Estelle and Joshua to Vaughn, you know, you don't have to be like, oh fuck, I'm like missing so much context. It's like, no, you know, it's. Okay, it's like a one line pretty much in that game. But as things have gone on after Daybreak, like Daybreak 2, you'll definitely need to know like Cold Steel 4 and Reverie, especially Reverie for Daybreak 2. And then this one, it's pulling on so many other different past events from different games because things are starting to like really coalesce once again in this game, like kind of unifying a lot of and expanding those concepts introduced in past games. So it's obviously gonna be the case of like this is gonna be very 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 tough to recommend to someone that hasn't played like, you know, a lot of these games already. Especially like I'm trying to think about like if you're trying to go into the like kind of Kiseki fresh, for instance, for whatever reason, it's like. You can do fine in terms of like gameplay, but like you should abandon all hope when it comes to story, like understanding the story, because it's already like you need to know a lot already.
That's a huge build up to this.
Yeah, like you have to understand, like, you know, like even small stuff. It's like for example, if you played Reverie and then you skip Daybreak 2 and then go into Kai, you know. A lot of it will be like, why is this character here, or why are they involved, you know, like stuff like that. You know, it's just like it's tough already. So I think it's an interesting game. There's like some cool gameplay system advancements of like how they continue to advance the formula of that action and turn based hybrid system, because that this is definitely also a game that like. You should be comfortable by now on how those systems operate, because the game does not hold your hand. Like, enemies are very aggressive in their attacks, and the action flow is pretty, pretty fast-paced. Like, you have to be kind of on your shit on that. But I think just this kind of like dragged on, like, first 40-hour impression so far is, like, there's some real bad pacing issues to the ramp up of this game, where, like, things don't really start moving in a direction until like maybe like 12 to 15 hours in.
Yeah, even like the first part of the first act is like these side quests felt like a repeat of like Daybreak 1. It's like, oh, a guy got scammed. Can I call like, you know, the fixers, which is the Spriggan, to fix this for me? You know, it's like, oh man, it's like I feel like I've seen this before, right?
Yeah.
I talked about this when I played Daybreak 1 and talked about it back in June. And like, I don't think they really sold the concept of these are jobs the bracers don't dare touch, because a lot of it just felt like not quite like the bracer could have done this. Like, I didn't quite buy the this is a Spriggan, this is dark, this is mature stuff, the, you know, this has to be off the record. And it's like, there was a little bit of that. I don't want to discount it completely, but only barely, only because I was thinking about it. Yeah.
I will say though, like, obviously I can't go into it, but despite some of the pacing problems I have with this game, there are still some really, really, really strong scenes in this game that, like, kind of make the payoff of, like, the new Calvert cast worth it. There are definitely some scenes in this game. It's like, oh, I didn't know Falcom would go in this direction, and, like, when these characters are presented the way that they did, oh, that's really, really cool. And, like, in the way that they actually actively crafted, and, like, the payoff of these scenes is, like, it's like, it's actually really well done. Something I would have never really expected out of Falcom. And obviously I can't really go into detail like what those scenes are, but there, I'm interested to see where this game stops. Because a lot of the game so far is like, in terms of like, it's leading up to this like big shuttle launch of launching the first team into space. So kind of the bulk of the game so far is like the 2 to 3 days before that shuttle launch. I wonder where the actual endpoint is for this game and how it will end, and if it's a conclusive ending or not. I have no idea. So I don't know. I'll probably find out
next week.
Yeah, pretty much. So it's been interesting to kind of just see unfold. It's been crazy.
I'm trying to think though, like the whole games from Kai to Trails in the Sky 1, which is getting a remake next year, is like 9 in-game years or something like that, right? 8. And I remember in Trails in the Sky 1, they're like, wow, a telephone. And now they're like, wow, a spaceship within 9 years. Orbital technology is crazy.
It's a grin login.
The whole progression of technology in Trails is fucked up, but also like different regions are just like so technologically behind. That's like, it's kind of crazy too.
Yeah, it's
supposed to be like on the same continent, but like the leftmost regions, like it's stuck like almost in the fantasy ages, while like the rightmost regions are like the most modern. They have like, you know, telephones, like smartphones, cars, now launching into space. So it's a crazy fucking world. You know?
There's a term they call that in like manga or something, because this ongoing manga goes on for like 30 years. Like they were using like, you know, like old school like holding phones, right? And then when you read like the most latest issue, they're using cell phones when it took place in like the 70s or something when it first started, right?
Yeah,
so, I forgot what the term is called, but there's something they call that.
Yeah. So Kaido Kiseki, we don't have a release date for it. You know, it's not even confirmed for the West yet, but obviously it probably will get a call, like, you know, some announcement after Daybreak 2 gets an official Western release. So we're all crossing our fingers for like maybe a late 2025 release at the earliest. But if not, maybe we'll slip into 2026 as well. But it's gonna, I'm interested to see, you know, like how people process Daybreak 2 and then obviously whatever, however this game shakes out, because this game is so, it's very dense. But I will say that I kind of feel a tiny bit bad of, like, you know, because they keep on introducing, like, new elements. Like, a very new minor element in this game is, like, Vaughn has a food blog. So you upload, like, food spots and, like, and the various people in the cast give them a review. So it's just, like, another, like, flavor thing that Nice America has to localize as well. And then they'll have to do, like, they'll have to do all, like, the timely words. Like entries as well.
It's probably gonna call it something else, because I don't know. A lot of these terms never got the exact terms. Like, Reverie's like cross story became Trails to Walk or something.
Yeah.
We're not sure what these terms are gonna be officially called.
Yeah.
What do you think the title will be?
Trails of the Realm.
Of the Realm.
I want. Yeah. It's kind of like encompassing the world. So it's like it has to be like trail like. If you're gonna go in the spirit of it, it's like, you know, Trails of the World or like
for the countries. Realm. I don't know. Yeah. It's like Kai is like a realm, like a different world kind of term, right? That's kind of like the direct translation of it. So
yeah. So I don't know. Who knows? I have no idea.
But that's my guess, I guess, right? Yeah. I hope they keep the subtitle though. But they already dropped Crimson Sin, so it's already too late.
Yeah, they don't. All these fucking things get fucking. All the subtitles get dropped. Like the end of Saga, which is a dumb subtitle.
It is a dumb silent because it's not the.
Oh, that reminds me. The tangent here. Are we wrapping up the discussion on Kaino Koseki?
Yeah, this is a
tangent, but it's something that you would have talked about last week. The new Yakuza game, Like a Dragon game. Uh-huh. Yeah. Like that one still has the Gaiden. So the English name is Like a Dragon Pirate Yakuza in Hawaii. Like they had to get Yakuza in there. But in Japan, it's just a Gaiden title, like the man who lost his name. But they don't want to use Gaiden in the West. It's very strange.
Yeah, I imagine there's like some weird meetings about that, because I think they did say like they're wondering if they're gonna have Gaiden in it for the Western release or not. Because I don't know, it's a miracle that these games sell. Because like the naming convention for them is so fucking, it changes from game to game. It feels like Sega is the Western Sega branch can't make up their mind on how a consistent naming scheme anymore for these games. The name in Hawaii is like Ryuga Gotoku 8 Gaiden. It's like Pirates in Hawaii or something like that, or Pirates Hawaii.
But even like the mainline games had subtitles. And we got the one for 6, Song of Life, but we didn't get the ones for 7 or 8, which were like Whereabouts, Light and Darkness, and I don't remember what 8 was.
That's a consistent thing, because like the what we consider the older Yakuza games here also had subtitles that they always dropped.
So they only gave us one for 6, I suppose. Yeah.
Yeah, the other yeah, 6 was like the exception for whatever reason. So it's. Even back then, they didn't have the consistent naming scheme for whatever reason.
So, before we go into news, we do have a few previews up from TGS from James. And one of those is a hands-on preview with Like a Dragon, Pirate Yakuza in Hawaii. He also went hands-on with a few more games we'll talk about later in the podcast. So Monster Hunter Wilds, he has a hands-on preview for that, as well as the first Berserker Kazan, the Souls-like featuring Ben Starr. That's the way I think of that one.
Yeah, nice.
So long story short, we have 3 at the time of recording hands-on previews written for the site from James, and I'm assuming he'll have more. Of course, we'll follow back up with James when he returns from Tokyo Game Show, and of course we are going to go into a lot of the news announcements, trailers coming out of TGS, but we do have
before we go into that, I just want to say that like the set list for the Falcom JDK band first part of their concert at TGS is really funny, because they market it as like, you know, since Kaino Koseki is a brand new release in Japan, we're gonna have the Falcom, like they always do these they always had the Falcom JDK band like doing live concerts at TGS, like mini concerts. So and it's like split up into 2 parts, like for each public day. So like the set list for this first part was like the BGM for the very first like web commercial for Kaino Koseki, like the crazy violin, which is really cool, and the opening theme of the game, which I really like, and then the rest of it is like really funny, because it's like the next one is like Inevitable Struggle from the Crossbell games, then the opening theme of Azure after it, then to celebrate Trails of the Sky, the first remake, they did like Sophisticated Fight, the battle theme of Sky live. Along with like some like a med, it transitioned to like a medley of like field themes from the Sky games, which is like really cool. Then they did the ending theme of the first chapter. Then it goes really weird, because to wrap it up, their last 2 songs after that were like the Nayura no Koseki opening theme and Go Fight, which is their goofy song for the Falcom. I forgot, like Gakuen or something, but it's it was a wild concert. It was they stopped to do the second part. I don't know if they're gonna have another new set list or not, but it's kind of like it was really just funny to see, like, you know, they kind of went backwards in time into like a really goofy ending spot, and I kind of love
it. And covering some of the more like Nayuta is kind of an oddball thrown in there.
It's like, okay.
All right, we'll go into the news here, and like we kind of stated, there's a lot coming out of TGS. Of course, we did also get some updates, long-awaited updates from some Level 5 projects. We also did have a State of Play with a few things that were relevant to our interests. The order I have here is trying to put some major announcements up front, some updates for some previous announcements after, and then obviously as normal, the sales updates and just new release dates kind of at the back. But otherwise, the order is just kind of random. We're going to start out here with probably the most surprising announcement, at least when I came back from my vacation and started looking at the headlines. This is the one that I was like, oh, wait, really? This came out of the State of Play, and this is the announcement from Gung Ho Entertainment of a new remastered collection for Lunar. So this is a remaster of Lunar Silver Star Story Complete and Lunar 2 Eternal Blue Complete. Those were the Sega PlayStation remasters of Lunar 1 and 2. I have not played these original games, but I've always
been an expert of Lunar. Trust me.
I am not surprised. All right, Chow, take it away.
So, so they were originally released on the Sega CDs, mm-hmm. and then they were remade on the PlayStation, but the first game has a wild treatment. Like, the story is completely rewritten, and the gameplay is completely different, right? The second game is more, it's more true to the Sega CD version. It's, like, or closer, but still vastly different, I would say. So, one of the biggest difference with, like, the Sega CD version versus like the PlayStation version for like Eternal Blue, which is the second game, is that you get like this magic experience points to level up your abilities. And for working design changes, they like to change the system or anything that thinks to get rid of the to add more difficulty to the game or some shit. They will be like, oh, well, now it costs magic experience to save the game now, because they don't want people to save anywhere like the original Japanese version does. So that's like some of the changes that you would get, right? But I don't think we want to talk about the gameplay aspect because nobody seems to know much about these games, right? So they're very simple, like old traditional RPGs. They don't
Before we go into the too much more of the details here, I am interested in them, but just to make sure we get the key points here. So announced at a State of Play, but releasing for PC, Xbox, and Switch next year. From Gung Ho, they're the same team that did the Grandia remaster. So it's going to have an option to do it in the original view or in the remastered view. It'll have new voiceovers, both in the Japanese or a new English voiceover for the animation sequences. They have some like some of the traditional trappings of these remasters, like a sped up battle option and things like that. But yeah, coming out next year for all consoles and PC.
I don't know if I don't think it has new in Japanese voices. The English, yes, but Japanese.
The English voices for sure, but the Japanese.
Yeah, I was trying to be careful with my language. Yeah, the new English voices or Japanese. I didn't mean to transitive property that new to both things. But yeah, you're right.
So if you watch the English trailer, you could hear the lyrics of the song, the opening song, because that's the working design translation of the song. They completely rewrote the opening song because they find the original opening song kind of boring, so they kind of like just completely change the lyrics. And the song that you could hear in that intro, it's like, oh yeah, they're using those lines, but it sounds like a different person singing it, or maybe it is the original singer, but her voice sounds much older, I guess. I don't know, right? So, but
yeah, I'm not sure. I don't know if like because there was some indie project that came out and like had the original singer that's involved with them, the implying that like she wasn't involved in this remaster. I'm not exactly 100% sure how that shook out. The flow of information is fucked up, but I'm not exactly sure like what's actually the truth behind that. We just know that like we had the English song that a lot of people resonated with when they first played these games in the West.
Because if you know that Xseed also did like the, what's that, localization for the remake on the PSP, right, of Silver Star Story, they got the original singer back, but this time they used a lyrics that's more closer to the original Japanese translation, right? And mm-hmm. people didn't seem to respond to that new version too well, right? Even though it's more accurate to the Japanese version, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So,
yeah.
But yeah, you can see it from there. I am kind of hyped for these remasters because they're really hard to get, or at least play in some accessible in some form. I do prefer the Sega CD versions over the PlayStation versions, but they're not going to remaster one of those games.
I guess that's the main like footnote here, that these are remasters of a remaster in some ways, where that original remaster, like you said, Chow, has already taken liberties from the original game.
But at the same time, a lot of people in the West played the PlayStation 1 version, not the Sega CD version. So if you're appealing to nostalgia, you would do this version and not the Sega CD version, because you want the one that most people in the West grew up with, at least when you're trying to market these.
Well, I'm happy for it. That means my Sega CD version is a collector's item, and that's going to be still worth $500 on eBay.
But they have the usual modern conveniences, like battle speed up, for these.
I wonder if they would change a lot of the things, because this game had sort of like a, you know, in Trails where you had to talk to the right person to get a book.
Yeah.
Okay. In the original Lunar, you basically have to talk to the person at the right time to get a picture of them. It's a bromide, and it's like a collector's item. But the thing is, like, that's only a problem in the English version. Working design changes that you can only, like, talk to people at the right time to get the picture. So they become, like, super easy to miss getting the whole thing. And I'm not sure if they would, like, change the gameplay to have, like, you know, like the original Japanese version where
it's hard to tell, like, if they're doing the working designs version or like scaling back some of the working designs gameplay changes. I don't know exactly if they've really got into or detailed that whole thing.
I'm not sure how it goes. They also like made like two bosses like extremely hard in the working design version. I think it's like one of the dragons that you fight in Internal Blue, and there's a guy called Bert Bogar, I think is his name. I forgot his name. But he was like a very difficult boss in the English version. Not much of a threat in the Japanese version, but in the English version, they're like overtune this guy and it's like super hard, right? So I'm not sure if they're gonna like reverse those changes as well, right?
Yeah. So, I mean,
we can speculate, but it's hard to know.
Yeah. And also, it's gonna have two new subtitle language options in French and German as well. So just making it more accessible to more languages is good. So yeah, I mean that's kind of like the whole summary of the announcement. It was a really, really cool out of nowhere announcement, and just having this re-release just to preserve it and make it accessible on modern platforms is a win-win. You know, hopefully it becomes like a really good version of the game, because I know a lot of people had misgivings with the Grania release when Gung Ho did that. We'll have to see. But
remind me, the Grandia release, you couldn't toggle. Could you toggle between the art styles, or were you stuck with a new one?
I don't know if you. I can't. I don't remember. I just know there was like some fucked up graphical shit going on that made it look worse than the old version.
So no, yeah, also one gameplay tip for you guys: if you ever decide to buy this game, buy 4 bars of soap. Okay, that's all I need to tell you.
Buy 4 bars of soap. I will totally forget that when the game goes out.
Yeah, I played these on PS1, but I don't have like a lot of memories about it because.
Okay, so basically, you buy a soap, you can use the hot springs later.
I thought you were going to keep it mysterious.
Yeah,
but it's very hard to get to those hot springs. So make sure you have 4 bars of soap. Make sure you have 4 bars.
Okay. So a couple other game announcements from the last week. This is one that I think is a bit of a surprise. This was from Koei Tecmo's TGS stream. Atelier Resleriana is coming to consoles, but it's a different version from the Atelier Resleriana that released for mobile this year. Like we talked about how this was their flagship title for this year was a mobile game that was going to be kind of a celebration title that, you know, with the free-to-play gameplay system, introducing characters from previous entries, etc., etc. Obviously, we have the recently announced Atelier Yumiya as the next mainline title coming out next year, but they are also working on Atelier Resleriana, The Red Alchemist, and The White Guardian as a console version releasing
timeout. So this is where everyone gets it wrong, and it's very obvious because no one played that game except me. There's not a console version of Atelier Resleriana. It is not the same game. It is a different game that takes place in the same world as Resleriana.
I'm totally willing to let you continue, but I was going there, just so you know.
Because you said it was a console version of that game. I'm like, timeout. It's not that. Yeah. I mean, yeah, because I've heard that misinformation from so many outlets that like it kind of pisses me off because it isn't, once again, it is not the same game as that Atelier Resleriana mobile game. It is a different cast, different characters. Resna is not the main character of this game. They showed off two different characters entirely in the teaser for this. It's coming to PS5, PS4, Switch, and PC via Steam in 2025. That's all they've really shown off is like some of the environments. Some of the environments are clearly from that mobile game, and to showcase that is in the same world as Resleriana. But this is not a console version of that game. There's an entirely new game set in the same world as that mobile game. That's pretty much the information around it. So I just want to clear up that misunderstanding, because people are like, oh, finally they're porting the mobile game to a proper console game, and that is not the case. So yeah, I just wanted to clear up that misunderstanding right away, because I've heard it from so many other sites, and it's really it's super obvious if you just like looked at the mobile game and then this game, like, you know, you can see that they're two entirely different games because they have different characters.
Yeah, the key art's completely different.
Yeah. So sorry if that was rude of you to butt in, but it's just like, I don't want to give people the wrong idea right away that it's that game.
Better tell them the hard truth.
I mean, it's annoying to me because it's like blatant misinformation, and it sucks for the people who are getting excited for like information that's not true, you know?
I think my favorite one is the Kai no Kiseki thing where they watch the Chinese stream where they blitz through the game in 20 hours and then they're like spreading misinfo.
That happens to every Kiseki game, so that's just like
and then everyone pretends that they know Japanese the next day for some stupid reason.
It's awesome. I love spreading misinformation. So yeah, that's kind of the sum of it. I mean, it's cool that like this they're doing this, and I think what's cool about it, right, because as someone who's played that mobile game that's on PC as well, is that the Atelier characters from other games that get like basically isekai'd in to it, exist within the world now, like as they're trying to find a way back to the original world. So they kind of like open up shop and have like different roles and ongoing journeys inside the world that they've been isekai'd in, which is Resler Rihanna's world. So you'll probably see them in this game. You know, who knows if they're going to be party members or not, but for sure they're definitely like characters you can interact with in this game, most assuredly. And it'll be interesting to see if you see that core cast from Resli Rihanna make an appearance in this game. I don't really know if I buy the quote unquote fan theory. I would say that like this is indicative of like Resli Rihanna like failing because they're making a console game based on that world, or for, you know, some people, you know, get the information wrong and think there's a console version. Like I think like because it's kind of those one of these weird things where like this has two different main characters. That's like, okay, then why are they doing this instead of like an in-game event in the game? It's just really hard to say at this point like what the scope of this game is and what they do with it. I think the concept is really neat. What I really 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 hope for is they keep the combat system of Resli Rihanna for this game and not try to invent some new stuff, because I really like the turn-based combat and like the turn manipulation, in Resli Rihanna. Like that's actually a really compelling battle system that they have in that game. So if they can keep that battle system and make it like, you know, more complex, more refined, like there's like a game I would theoretically be into, because I actually like the gameplay of that game. So yeah, we'll see. And once again, sorry,
I was kind of teeing it up in a way that was awkward. I should have just stated it outright, but yeah, and it's good to see like that. So obviously Atelier Yumiya is, we have a release date worldwide in March next year, and this is also slated worldwide for next year. I guess they haven't explicitly said it's a worldwide release, but they've said it's coming next year for all regions, so it's, you know, Atelier fans eating good, I suppose.
Yeah, I mean, yeah, they have an official Western, you know, trailer, so I assume it's coming.
Yeah, it's one of those things where they've released two games in a row worldwide, and this one likely the same unless plans change. But yeah, early in the year we'll have Yumiya, and potentially later in the year we'll have Red Alchemist and White Guardian, and of course the mobile game is not shutting down, so that'll keep going. There's two more announcements from indie studios before we go into updates for previously announced games coming out of TGS and otherwise this week. This one is a debut project for a small Canadian studio called Rio Games called Threads of Time. This is announced for Xbox Series and PC. Doesn't have a release window, but does have an announcement trailer. And on our website, we do have a series of screenshots alongside the announcement. Threads of Time is a debut project, very inspired by 16-bit RPGs. They explicitly call out Chrono Trigger. They show that both in their animated cutscenes in the trailer, as well as in several of the gameplay moments and the screenshots. They pull on that thread a lot in the announcement here for Threads of Time.
I have thoughts about this game. Well, not necessarily like the thoughts of the game. I think the trailer that they released seems really cool. They have like this nice pixel art style, almost like an HD 2D-esque type of game. Has a little bit too much bloom. But what they showed seems to have potential, because it's like a time-traveling RPG, so I see a lot of like different time periods that you travel through during the trailer when they unveiled it at the Xbox event at Tokyo Game Show. We knew about this game in advance because they sent us an embargoed email about, you know, just giving us a heads up of like, you know, make sure to... So we have proper prep time to like put up the announcement of it. If Adam was here, he would probably agree with me. The headline of this email is one of the most... it's a really bad headline. I will read this verbatim. On the headline, the spiritual successor to Chrono Trigger has arrived, the JRPG Threads of Time revealed during the TGS. There's a lot going on with this headline. You cannot call yourself the spiritual successor to Chrono Trigger when you have absolutely no thread to the original project with your staff, especially. Like for example, Eiyuden Chronicle, right? It's pretty, if they said we are the spiritual successor to Suikoden with Eiyuden Chronicle, that would make, and they pitched it like that, and it makes a lot of sense because a lot of the key staff members and creative members of Eiyuden Chronicle were involved with that, but, you know, Murayama, Kawano, and so forth, right? So that makes sense. You being the spiritual successor to Suikoden with Eiyuden Chronicle makes sense because you have some... You have a lot of the very key core pillars of that staff working on it, like creators on it. This has no connection whatsoever, any key staff members, really, from Chrono Trigger to call yourself, to warrant labeling yourself the spiritual successor to Chrono Trigger. Am I crazy?
No, it's...
No.
And there's almost like levels to this, like in the like you said, the trailer on its own, what they've shown, the screenshots on their own, it looks pretty, it looks promising. Now, obviously, that's all we have to go on just from a visual standpoint. Like Seas of Stars, I think in a lot of ways was received kind of lukewarm because it had a lot of the same sort of vibes to it, where it presented very well, showcased off in trailers very well, but maybe at the end just didn't quite come through at the end. Where here it's like, okay, it shows promise, but in their like press release for the game, within the very first sentence, they say a modern 2.5D love letter to the JRPG classics. Like, even if that's true, I don't think you have to lead with that. Just let it speak for itself. Like, I think of that Expedition 33, where when those devs talk about their game, they talk about what their favorite games were growing up, and you can kind of see what their inspirations are, and that's perfectly fine, but they don't say this is the spiritual successor to Persona or whatever. And so I just don't think, like, even if it's all true, you don't have to lead with it. I don't think you need to crutch on putting Chrono Trigger in the subject line of your email to sell your game. Your game can stand on its own. I don't know.
Yeah. It also, you know, doesn't feel great when one of the screenshots that they released was like, you know, emulating the campfire scene from Chrono Trigger as well. So it's like, oh, look at us, you know, we're doing the thing. It's like, I want to give this game a shot. And I plan to, you know, like, I definitely
am interested in a shot.
But
promising, obviously.
But my interest in a game immediately goes down like 50% when a game tries to do this kind of stuff of like, when they released language like we're the spiritual successor to this RPG that we have no ties to, or we're fixing the JRPG genre or whatever, we're fixing, you know, these tired RPG tropes.
I think you already have this conversation with Chain Echoes.
We've had this conversation multiple times, and I wish we in a perfect world we would never have this conversation because people would not do this. But we keep having this conversation because fucking people, like developers, keep on doing this, and it kind of is really annoying because it's like you're trying to make a game within the same genre, and you're supposedly like a love letter to it, yet your language is like insulting the genre itself, pretty much, right? It's like you claim you love the genre, but then you're like, oh, by the way, we're fixing it. You know, it's like that's not how you, like, you know, in my opinion, that's not really how you would show, like, you know, reverence or love to that genre. You'd be like, you know, like, this is our own spin on things. Like, here's how, or just let the game speak for itself. Like, here's some of the game mechanics that, you know, we're showing out. You don't have to say we're fixing the RPG genre, you know, as part of that statement. You can just let the game mechanics speak for itself and see if people like it or not, you know? You don't have to, like, be obnoxious about, like, the way that you present yourself. In my opinion. To me, that seems like the smart play. But, you know, I'm also not involved with the game's marketing either. But, you know, I will inherently have a lower opinion of your game, straight up, being honest, you know, when you do that. So it's just like, how do I express this? You're already at a lower point in, like, the starting line, I guess, in a race. Like, usually I kind of put everyone at the same spot in a race and a starting line, if I were to compare games as, like, a race. But now you have, like, a lower, or you're further, further back in the pack, so to speak, when I'm starting you.
they've kind of like poisoned the well, where it's like, oh yeah, this is the game that called themselves the spiritual successor to Chrono Trigger. Let's see what they've got. And then you're automatically, like, already under that scrutiny.
I was already burnt by that when Square did that with the Tokyo RPG Factory with I Am Setsuna. I'm like, are you sad yet? It's like, are you getting all that nostalgia? I'm like, oh my god, this game's trying too hard.
Yeah.
But yeah, and this game looks like it's a little bit further out, and maybe Adam is aware, like we've talked about with a lot of these titles, they kind of incubate in Indie Land Kickstarter. I'm not sure if this had any sort of crowdfunding behind it at all, and then it just has a formal announcement here at TGS. I don't think Xbox is publishing it, but obviously they've platformed it on their Xbox Showcase.
Humble Bundle Games or Humble Indie, whatever.
Humble Games.
Right, gotcha. And yeah, like could be interesting, could be promising, but yeah, always going to have kind of that way that it initially decided to present itself. No release date, no release window, currently only announced for Xbox as a console and of course on PC. But yeah, we'll keep eyes on it and see how it ends up compared to, like, the other contemporaries that we've talked about. And there's a few more that are also in the works too, like Sacrifier did a similar thing, maybe not as overtly. But they echoed, like, oh, we're inspired by Star Ocean and we've got Sakuraba, you know, and things like that. It's commonplace, I guess, is my thesis here. The last one we have, and one more indie title here before we go into other news. This is from developer Munana, who is, they just released Keylocker. We've talked about that over the podcast. They're also the developer behind Virgo versus the Zodiac. They've announced their next project. This is Clowned King. We just have an announcement teaser trailer for this, only a few seconds long, but it's a isometric turn-based tactical RPG. So kind of the grid-based Disgaea or FFT. I'm only using those as a description of the gameplay perspective based on the 30 seconds of trailer. And they have a couple screenshots, no release date or window yet, but basically an announcement of Munana's next project. Which is pretty interesting. I've not played Keylocker, but I really kind of like their art style there. They're kind of have their own theming going on where they don't have really any explicit genre that they're pulling from. They're kind of just being inventive with their own thing. And this is, I think, a cool project to keep our eye on for that studio.
Yeah, I mean, I'm interested to see, like, what the mechanics are. Like, unfortunately, Keylocker didn't really hit for me because I think the frequency of timed attacks those was a little bit too obnoxious for me based on the demo that I played. I don't know, fixed that up for the full release, but it was, like, really surprising to see, like, oh, they're ready to announce their, like, next project immediately after just releasing Keylocker. So you know, and it has a cool aesthetic.
All right, now we're going to go into like major trailers from other games. This is probably the big one from the week. I know a lot of people on our site and even in our community channel have this one circled. Monster Hunter Wilds. We were kind of expecting to see this, and of course we got it. We got a new trailer for Monster Hunter Wilds from TGS. We got the release date of February 28th of next year. I believe that's the same date as Hawaii Pirates Yakuza. And then we also got details for a lot of monsters that are unique to this game, new to this game, including the new flagship monster, Arkveld. Arkveld, we've got, obviously, it's showcased in the trailer. We've got a lot of screenshots and concept art for it. I don't know how it was described, like, within the chat when it was being shown, but me coming late to this, I'm like, that looks like a very scary Barioth with a dragon and a chain whip. That's kind of how I saw it, but it's very cool, very unique. And we also got some details for more hunters, NPCs in the story, at least at the prologue of the story, and a lot of different screenshots and details, including like a native species of feline called the Woodwoods, the Palicos, mm-hmm. in that region of the Scarlet Forest, a couple monsters that are unique to each of the biomes in each region. Were there any other highlights that came out of the monster hunting showing out of TGS?
Yeah, there's a little bit more. Like they had an extended cut of the trailer that confirms that Jan Kutku is coming back, which is like kind of like one of the bird wyvern monsters that you fight on very early on. But a lot of the Monster Hunter fans really like Jan Kutku.
That's the one that poisons the shit out of you, right? I believe.
It's not the one with the tongue.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. It has like kind of the birdish, like it's kind of like a big ostrich bird almost. During the TGS presentation for Monster Hunter Wilds, they showed off, you know, some of the gameplay, like the open like region and how big it is, and like the real time weather and lighting changes, which look really nice. They faced off against like that big huge aquatic monster. I forgot what it was called off the top of my head.
Oh, I was thinking of Yon Duruga. My bad.
So they showed off like the fight with the Uthduna and that looked crazy because it's like around a river. But the big one for Monster Hunter fans was they also confirmed that Kongalala is coming back to Monster Hunter Wilds. And for people who don't know Kongalala, and it's the monster known as the fart monster in the series, because it's like a big tall gorilla. And its main gimmick is like just farting a lot and like causing like, you know, kind of like a big stink status ailment on you. So, and of course, yeah, the weak spot is like its butt as well. So that was a fun, disgusting thing to come back. It's like, yep, there's the fart monkey. It's back. So it's going to be a lot of fun. It looks beautiful. I think people are getting a little bit worried about the requirements of this game and how it's going to run on consoles, because every showing of it on console has been kind of a mess performance-wise. Like, they haven't been able to stabilize performance in any of these showings on the consoles so far. And then on PC, like, I think there was like a PC requirements that they released after the release date trailer. And like a lot of it was like, hey, if you want to, like, it seems to imply that like, hey, if you want to have stable high frame rates, you know, this is we're releasing these requirements with the assumption that you have frame generation on or something, which is really only available on like the 4000 series, I believe, for NVIDIA. So I don't know. I don't know what to think. I really hope it doesn't launch in a really bad state performance wise. That's all I can really. That's the only sort of like commentary I can really give on it. It's like, man, I really hope when I fire this on PC, it's not a fucking mess.
Yeah, and it's obviously the first we've talked about. This is the first like truly worldwide crossplay, all consoles, PC. Well, not Switch, but you know, maybe Switch 2 later. But no delayed PC port, and then expansion after that coming off for different consoles differently. It's just all aligned. So it'd be nice if it just releases, has the crossplay, works well. They've had their kind of experience with releasing World and Rise, but this is obviously a different engine, so hopefully all goes as planned.
Yeah,
because it would suck if it didn't.
The release date is a little bit later than I wanted it to be, but it's okay. Sorry. You know, it's gonna be a good time, but I just hope that it does. I don't have to like. I really hope that it just launches in a stable state for all the platforms that it releases in, really.
And I'll remind that James was recently able to go hands-on. I have not read his preview, but he has written it and put it up on the site, I think, within the last day or two at the time of recording. So if you want to see some hands-on or read some hands-on impressions for Monster Hunter Wilds, James has those up on the site. We finally got a lot of updates for upcoming Level 5 titles from their Vision 2024 to the World's Children event. We talked about in the past, obviously they announced a lot of titles all at once a little over a year ago. Some of them were originally slated to release last year. A lot of them were moved to this year. We were wondering the status of some of these, including like Inazuma 11 Victory Road had its private like beta events for the Switch and then other consoles earlier this year. We kind of got a follow up on a lot of these. So in no particular order, Inazuma 11 Victory Road will be releasing worldwide in June simultaneously for all consoles, PS5, PS4, Switch, PC, and mobile devices. And then they released a new trailer for that, a pretty long trailer detailing a lot of the mechanics of the game. Of course, we kind of talked about this because I forget, Josh, did you play one of the technical stress test events for?
Yeah, I played their betas. Yeah, they're fun. I mean, like that. I didn't like go like too ham on them, but like, you know, it's a fun game to just kind of learn and explore and see, like, you know, what this new entry of Inazuma 11 is about. I've never really played an Inazuma 11 game, so it was fun, like, discovering, like, how do they adapt, like, you know, RPG mechanics into, like, soccer, and that was a lot of fun. The fun new thing that they unveiled in this new trailer is, like, there's a new commander mode that you can use in all the gameplay modes, so it's, like, an alternative control scheme for the game, where instead of, like, directly controlling your players like in real time, like any other sports game or action game, really. This one like lets you all do it through like a menu in real time. So it's kind of interesting to see like, oh, there's a way to like kind of operate everything through a menu, but things are still going on. It's not like turn based or anything. Like, yeah, things are still happening in real time. So I wonder. I'm interested. I kind of want to try it out and see like if this is like. A more versatile way to like play the game. I don't know. It's you know, I just thinking about the scope of this game is like overwhelming because they're like, oh, we bumped up the playable character or players in this game from 4,500 to 5,200 characters in this game. I'm like, yep, that's a big number. Fuck. So yeah.
And then this is one when I was going through the headlines to prepare for this podcast, this is one I also wasn't expecting. I assume alongside that, in the same presentation, Level 5 announced that they are going to be remaking the original Inazuma 11 for 2026, called Inazuma 11 Re, so remake for the 15th anniversary, coming out in the year after Victory Road, and they had a trailer for that as well.
Yeah, it's coming to PS5, PS4, Switch, and PC, so we still get PS4 releases in the year 2026, still going strong. And, you know, it's a remake project for the very first Inazuma 11 game that came out, I believe, it was like DS, I think it came out, or 3DS, I forgot, I think it's DS.
I think it's DS, yeah.
Yeah. And yeah, I mean, you know, a lot of people who are Inazuma 11, you know, fans, just, you know, they fell in love with the series there. That kind of is the entry point of like this big mega hit like soccer RPG series. And
I think my friend was trying to get me into this game because Shaolin Soccer just came in theaters and we watched that. And then he's like, "You want something even more over the top? Try this." I'm like, "Ah, that's okay." So that's kind of like my history with it.
Yeah. And it was funny because like the way they framed the trailer, it's like, oh shit, there's no more stylus that we can use for this game. What are we gonna do? So they had to like kind of also overhaul the gameplay without having, because you know, you don't have a stylus anymore. You know, we'll see that eventually, and it's gonna be, you know, gonna be released worldwide. I don't know if it's simultaneous worldwide or anything, but you know, level 5 is, you know, pushing towards that now. So all the best to them.
Another Level 5 product that we were wondering, and I think we kind of all anticipated this, but Deca Police, which has kind of had a long, maybe not long, but a slightly troubled development cycle based on its initial debut and kind of the lack of information following has been officially pushed into 2026. However, they've also announced that it is committing itself to a PC release, which I think was kind of all but confirmed before. It wasn't truly clear cut, as well as a simultaneous anime adaptation for the IP.
Yeah, they'd like to do this, like with Megaton Musashi, that also got the same treatment, where like the original release of Megaton Musashi got anime adaptation alongside them. So, I mean, you know, they like this cross-media strategy. Obviously, the big bummer is like, hey, this cool new like detective RPG was like initially slated to release in 2024, now all the way pushed back to 2026. Obviously, because of James's reports, like when he got to demo it, I think it was like, yeah, last year, for Dega Police, like, you know, we're already anticipating that it wasn't going to release in 2024 and possibly get pushed to this year, but now it's like, no, not even this year is going to get pushed down to not even next year. It's going to get pushed all the way back to
the year after. Was actually, the original trailer actually said 2023. So, yeah.
Oh, okay. Yeah, fuck. So, you know, it's...
I mean, games take time. I'm not judging them for that. I think it was always a little bit like, that's optimistic. It's probably going to get delayed. But yeah, hopefully it's had time to bake. And I know people that I've seen it hands off have been really, you know, interested in the concept and the idea behind it. And it's always just good to see new ideas come to the forefront. So I think this is a kind of an interesting and intriguing title to keep our eye on for 2026.
Yeah. Yeah. So the new trailer is like basically the theme song trailer for the game, some new footage. So we'll see it again when it's like hopefully near ready, you know. It's take all the time you need to make the game as good as you can.
I have a question. Do they have any announcements for the Professor Layton thing, or is that
like, obviously it's not within our scope, but they did show off Professor Layton, the new Layton game, like the new World of Steam, and they also have a demo for it at the Tokyo Game Show floor. That you can actually play it in English at the show floor. I forgot when that's releasing. I think it's sometime next year. I don't think it's...
That's so weird. I feel like the year before, they're like, oh, it's like Deckard Police is more ready. Now this game's more ready. Like, what?
Yeah. I forgot exactly what the release date for that one is. But yeah, I mean, it's in the works. It seems to be like, you know, their biggest Layton game yet. Hopefully that all shakes out.
And then one other game that was kind of, we've kind of always discussed, bundled with the other set from Level 5, Fantasy Life, the Girl Who Steals Time, was also supposed to originally release 2023. I was checking our old news posts and scrolling backwards to see. Announced around the same time, early 2023, originally supposed to release that year, is going to release now with a planned date of April 2025, and got a new trailer alongside that. Alongside a release date announcement.
Yeah, is there, like the last slated release date before the April 2025 was the October 10th, 2024. But now they officially confirmed the release window is April 2025. Still coming only to the Switch, and then the big unveiling here is like there's like a whole big open world area to the game that you can explore, and you can like switch like different like life jobs classes on the fly as well in the game. So, you know, it's all the best to them, you know. Hopefully it works out. Can you say
2025/2026 will be the year of Level 5?
That's right.
Another trailer here. This is a trailer for a game we've talked about once before, announced back in May. This is a first-person hack and slash called Voin. So basically, it's almost like a high-speed... what was that name? Mordhau? The first-person...
Mordhau?
Yeah, it was like that. It's like that in terms of its gameplay being purely first-person melee combat, only with a very like fantasy, grim, dark aesthetic. And it's basically has a new trailer and has announced it'll be available with a demo for the next Steam Next Fest, which I don't know if we have dates for that, but it's slated for October.
So I think it's like October 14 to 21. Those are the dates.
Yeah, and they've talked about that, what the demo will have available to players. But they just released a short new trailer for their game, which kind of has an interesting gameplay concept and will be playable within a few weeks alongside the Steam Next Fest. And we always try, especially Josh, you're good at really focusing on a lot of the interesting projects coming out of those demos. So not only do we have a lot of new games releasing in October, but we'll have a lot of demos coming out as well for games further down the road that I'm sure we'll want to try to keep an eye on as many of those as possible. A few kind of other incidental updates here. Some of these have some accompanying trailers and some don't. One of the early releases for next year in January is the recently announced Tales of Graces remaster. Bandai Namco basically just talked about some of the things that are going to be present for the new remastered edition of this game. They talked about how you'll be able to access the grade shop right away. You'll be able to have a dash for the overworld and a toggle for no encounters. They've added subtitles for things that were previously weren't subtitles, like battle chants during like Mystic Arts or post-battle comments, which is pretty common for this era of Tales games. They've said that previous DLC will be included, except for cases where it was like licensed content. DLC skits will now be voiced in English. There was one little footnote that Cherryo's VA won't be returning for the skits. Instead of Laura Bailey, it'll be Alexis Tipton. So immediately I saw several comparisons to the Tales of Vesperia remaster, where they did some VA change outs in the middle of the game. Luckily here, it seems like it's only limited to some DLC skits, so much less pervasive throughout the game.
It's not all the skits. It's only like,
the previous unvoiced DLC skits, which I don't know what those consisted of, but yeah, just a handful of skits.
Mm-hmm.
Let's see. Grade Shop. I'm trying to see. New destination on the map for the main story will now be highlighted by an exclamation point icon, adjusted cursor movement speed. If you go to our news post on this or from Bandai Namco directly, they kind of detail in basically an ordered list all the updates for the remastered edition. A lot of it is stuff you've seen before. It's nothing too surprising here.
Mm-hmm.
So. We have an update for a game that we just first talked about back in May. This is kind of an interesting project from Tipwork Studio called Ballad of Antara. It is a free-to-play game that presented itself like a Souls-like. It originally debuted and was announced with a pretty long trailer that was a combination of like cinematics and some gameplay and showcased a variety of characters. So there's nothing's been explicitly shown from the developer, as I can tell, but because it showed multiple characters and multiple gameplay styles, that will likely tie into the free-to-play like monetization system, but none of that's been truly like laid out. And we have another trailer here that is basically 15 minutes of footage showcasing primarily gameplay with a few cinematics within the game, again, showcasing multiple characters. Very, very much just kind of still shows that Souls-like, Elden Ring-like gameplay actually shows the UI elements which we always like to see, but still no real details on how the game is structured other than the story mode is single player and will have cooperative elements, but how those are implemented. Is it like a summon sort of system like the games, or is it separate from the main game? I'm not sure. But it's a decent look of a lot of gameplay from Ballad of Antara, slated for next year. We also got, this is also coming out of the State of Play. This is something that I think no one is surprised by, but Stellar Blade, which of course released earlier in this year for PlayStation 5, very much inspired by the likes of Nier Automata, will now have a crossover with Nier Automata. I think this is not a surprise for both the IPs in question. We got a trailer announcing the crossover. It just said soon, so I don't know if any other dev interview or blog has given any sort of release window for this. It'll also update photo mode, this update to Stellar Blade.
Yeah, I don't know if they gave it a date, but they've been patching that game to,
There was a recent patch lately which they improved the juggle physics.
There's like graphical enhancements and physics enhancements like in a recent patch as well. So they continue to add updates to that game. Like there's like a summer event that was previously a limited time summer event, but now I guess there's like a toggle for it, like you can flip it on or off, so like you can have like, so I think they're gonna time gate that anymore, which is a good decision, because why would you have fucking
time gate on a single player
limited time FOMO content in a single player game
that you can
play offline? Seems So it's a good thing they backtracked on that and just made that always accessible, especially like what about the players who are waiting for the PC version as well, too. But it's a totally, you know, when they announced that they were going to collaborate with something, everyone knew what the fuck they were gonna collaborate with. There's only one clear answer to that, and of course it was Nier Automata.
Look, Yokotaro says if you pay him, you can collab anything, okay?
Yeah, they'll do anything for money. So, and they lean
into that, and I think they explicitly quoted this announcement and said we'll do anything for money. I'm almost a little tired of hearing that. Like, yes, they will.
Yeah,
I mean, the novelty has kind of worn off, but it's like whatever, man. It's like
at this point, it's just like lean into it. We get it.
Yeah. I mean, at least they're true to it, you know, and they're being honest about it. Just say it. I kind of wish more people were like, yeah, we'll just do it. Well, if you give us money, we'll do it.
Yeah, he's like my favorite spokesperson. It's like everyone's like asking for like these, these very complex questions. And he's like, oh, I just like women or money or something like that. It's so simple. It's like, why can't the world just be that way?
if only.
A couple years ago, about a year and a half ago, we had the announcement of Arc Age 2 from Kakao Games. Kakao Games? How do you pronounce that? K-A-K-A-O Games.
Kakao?
It is Kakao, yeah.
Kakao Games. So that was the MMO that originally released in 2013. They announced an Arc Age 2 back in 2022. Arc Age's servers actually had a shutdown notice earlier this year from late June. So I'm not entirely sure about how that was received, but... during the state of play, it did kind of resurface as an announced project for both consoles, PlayStation and Xbox and PC for next year, only now under the name Arc Age Chronicles. And this is not the first time we've seen this. We've kind of had similar things where like very MMO styled games, like the New World is having that, either has or recently had that Aeternum update where it came to consoles and isn't calling itself an MMO. Crimson Desert isn't calling itself an MMO. Arc Age Chronicles, in the press release for this new revision of what was previously Arc Age 2, they said, this new title represents our vision of combining the expansive, immersive elements of an MMO with the dynamic, engaging gameplay of an online action RPG. So they're not shying away from saying, yes, it has MMO elements into it. But I'm like, an MMO can have action combat. Like, it can still be an MMO. That's me reading that.
It's impossible. It's impossible. It can't be done.
Yeah, like I know like WoW and FF14 and other games like tab targeting is kind of maybe what comes to mind. But, you know, there have been other games that have had action combat in an MMO. But yeah, the still slated to come out next year under the name Arc Age Chronicles. It'll come out for PC and consoles at the same time. And we have the new trailer alongside that announcement. We have another update for Front Mission 3 remake. Of course, all the Front Mission remakes were kind of announced at the same time, all from Forever Entertainment, being developed by different studios. We've talked about the release of the first two Front Missions over the last couple of years, primarily, unfortunately, circled around some pretty bad and strange translation issues with those games. And we finally got our first real look at Front Mission 3, which before had kind of been like a, yes, we're working on it, but worry about it until the other two come out. Demo gameplay, about 25 minutes of gameplay for the upcoming Front Mission 3 remake.
Yeah, the translation issues was primarily around Front Mission 2, because the first Front Mission remake, they kind of got the script from the
DS version, probably.
Yeah, DS version. This is, I don't know, man. I know this is like a super early build. I know this is super early build or not, but I'm not liking what I'm seeing for this Front Mission 3 remake.
Now all the characters got like that golden sun effect where everyone's like, they're talking like that.
Yeah, really? So like for example, like yeah, when dialogue is being spoken, every single character that appears on screen for each word that they're speaking into a dialogue text box has a sound effect that's really annoying. Because it's just like you just have like obnoxious sound effects as like anyone is speaking, and that'll get tired really, really fast. I was already getting tired of it by like skimming through it, so not looking good for the full game on that. The game itself is like somewhat like the Wanzers feel very weightless during the footage. Like they don't feel heavy. They're kind of like look like toys roaming around the battlefield, and like the battle animations are very, very basic and don't really feel have they don't really have like any sense of weight when they go through it, and just in general, just the aesthetics of it, it just kind of looks worse than the PS1 version, which is kind of amazing.
How can you do such a thing at this era?
Yeah, I don't understand. So, I mean, Front Vision 3 is like a decent entry. Like, you know,
it's one of the better ones,
yeah,
in my opinion.
Yeah, it's a decent entry in Front Vision, but this remake is, I don't know if it's really doing it justice. Hopefully it's just like a super, super, super early build, and it's totally not going to be what's going to be in the final version. But based on the track record of these remakes, even though they're from different development studios, this whole remake trilogy for Front Mission has kind of just been a big-ass disappointment.
Only Square would just do it themselves, but they're probably always short-staffed at this moment.
Yeah, Square Enix short-staffed that for sure. No, just like, you know, I just kind of wish they kind of showed it more love and care for this series, but I don't know. It was just kind of a bummer just skimming through this gameplay and be like, yep, it looks like ass.
Awesome. Now, remind me, they're all still on Switch, right?
They're all initially released on Switch, but the previous two remakes already came to other platforms. But they all of them always released first on Switch.
Gotcha.
And
so
then eventually they come to other platforms after.
Okay, cool. Thanks for the reminder.
Mm-hmm.
And we kind of already talked about this. Metaphor Re Fantasio has a demo. Kind of got leaked by, what was it, Sony Korea or?
It's like Atlas Korea or something.
Atlas Korea, that's what it was.
Yeah.
Now available demo for Metaphor coming out mid-October.
Yeah, it has the same data transfer. It's actually a beefy demo.
Yeah.
Like you can get like 5 to 6 hours out of it.
Or that's even what I had heard too, yeah. Training.
Yeah, mm-hmm. So, you know, for people who are just interested, like seeing, oh, what do they have in store? Like, you know, so give it a try for yourself, you know. It seems to be like a really interesting idea that they have in store.
Yeah, I know the demo has not been received well on PC because of some performance issues, but I know Atlas has released a statement basically saying that they're working on it.
Yeah, hopefully that's comes out sooner rather than later, because it never really feels good to like a lot of your first impressions of the game is like, man, this runs like ass.
Mm-hmm.
That's never the first impressions you want to hear.
Mm-hmm. We have one sales update. We have that Unicorn Overlord, of course, the Vanillaware project that released in March this year, has hit 1 million units sold, which kind of puts it kind of on par with Vanillaware's other successful titles like 13 Sentinels Aegis Rim, also hit the 1 million sales mark late last year. Unicorn Overlord's available on more platforms, so you can dive into the technicalities if you want, but of course, good success for the game. They released some new artwork celebrating the milestone, and kind of a game that I played through and enjoyed quite a bit, and will be interesting to see kind of what its lasting impressions are compared to the rest of that of Vanillaware's filmography.
Congratulations, Vanillaware gets to continue existing.
If only they use some of that budget to make a PC version.
It feels like they live precariously and they live dangerously. Mm-hmm. But awesome.
Yeah, the development history is crazy. It's like, oh, I'm just gonna take my entire life savings to make this game. It's like, what?
If any of our games underperform, we're doomed. But luckily, we always pull through.
Fucking Vanillaware, dude. So, you know, hopefully within the next decade, we'll see what they're working on next. And hopefully within the next decade, they'll start, you know, putting some of their previous titles and current titles on more platforms like PC and PC and PC. Mm-hmm. So, but you know, but what do I know, you know? And, clearly, I don't like making money. So,
you're allergic to money.
Yeah.
I guess I could have talked about this next headline with the same at the same time as the I guess it's not really a demo at Xbox's TGS stream. A lot of the Final Fantasy titles that had previously skipped Xbox are now available on Xbox Series digitally as well as part of Game Pass. So Trials of Mana, Legends of Mana, and the Pixel Remaster for the Final Fantasy series are all available on Xbox Series. With the Trials of Mana and Legend of Mana available to Windows Game Pass subscribers. So kind of one of those things where we had, obviously, the announcement from Square Enix about entering their new kind of marketing phase over between 2024 and 2026, kind of having a more global approach to the release cadence. We've talked about many times about how the schizophrenia of what they've released randomly hodgepodge across platforms and exclusivity and things like that. We've already seen some of the things come to light in terms of wanting to put more things on more platforms. And now we get into some of the Xbox holdouts from their series released on the Xbox Series.
I'll move it up here because it's relevant, but like we just recently, it's like we still see some of that from Square Enix with Triangle Strategy launching off for MetaQuest on October 31st.
Oh, yeah, I forgot I put that down there. Yeah, Triangle Strategy is Adam had to remind me that this had released obviously on as a Switch exclusive and later came to PC. It's still not on Xbox, but it is on MetaQuest coming out or will be on MetaQuest on October 31st. I'm not sure that an isometric strategy RPG is the best fit for a VR game, but maybe I'll ask someone who's a little bit more into the VR space about.
Yeah, I mean the trailer for it is like, oh, it's kind of cool because it's kind of like, you know, a diorama, like almost like controlling a diorama with your hands and stuff. But like the concept is cool. I don't know if I'd replay Triangle Strategy if I had a VR headset around for it. But like it's a cool concept, but it's like you would think that like this title would probably do better if like it was on Xbox and PlayStation first before MetaQuest. It's like I'd have to think that like the resources poured into the MetaQuest release of this game is probably more than it would be on Xbox and PlayStation, I would think. But what I know, you know,
yes.
It's just like I don't know. They still get some of this weird shit from Square Enix, man. I just don't understand.
I don't know. It's always a questionable decision with this company every year.
Like you just get the occasional Square Enix of like they're doing what?
Imagine if they did something like that. It's like Final Fantasy VII Part 3.
Yeah,
on VR.
It's like, yeah.
It's one of those things where, like, sure, like, I'm not a huge VR aficionado. I like to see it supported. I know a lot of people that do report really good, you know, experiences that can only be experienced that way. But then you kind of say, like, well, you just talked about these other games releasing on Xbox. Triangle Strategy is still a holdout. And I'm sure it'll come eventually, but I can't say that with confidence. I wouldn't put money on it.
I don't know. This seems kind of random. Is there a game that you're interested to see from Square Enix on VR?
Wait, what?
I said, is there a game that you're interested from Square Enix that you want to see on VR?
The FF7 remakes, the remake and rebirth, like just do it all first person.
Mm-hmm.
You are now Cloud or Barrett.
Oh, damn. Tifa. I gotta get to the date soon immediately.
Playing as like any of those characters, like especially Barrett or Tifa in VR first person, would be fucking sick.
Imagine doing the Yuffie thing, flying around.
Yeah, let me fly
sickness.
Yeah, let me just hurl immediately as playing as Yuffie in VR. Awesome.
One thing that I might need to pick the brain on for someone who's a little bit more active in the VR space is I don't envy people or like publisher developers having to come up with like non-VR trailers to market their VR game. Like I was watching this Triangle Strategy VR trailer and they're like, look, you can like turn your head to watch animations on the side of the screen. And it's just like, cool, I guess. Or you could just center it on the screen. us 2D plebs. It's interesting, but it'll be cool to see like kind of the response to this, though it does seem like a strange decision.
It'll be cool to see the response if we hear any response. That's the thing. Like,
that's so true. Yeah. Yeah.
I don't know, but outside of James, I don't really know any VR players. So I'll be honest.
I think Scott did a few, but yeah, James on the podcast.
Can ask my brother, borrow his MetaQuest, I guess.
There you go. Chow on the scene. Right.
Chow, VR expert to be. All right, a few more days to go through here. Cryptmaster will be getting a console release on October 3rd for Xbox One and Series and PlayStation 4 and 5. Released on PC back in May. I believe James reviewed it. He previewed it. He didn't review it, but he did talk about his time with that game. Here's kind of an interesting one. Horizon Zero Dawn Remastered will be launching on October 31st for PlayStation 5 and PC. Obviously, the original game came out in 2017. There's already been a lot of discussion kind of in the online spaces about whether a remaster for Horizon Zero Dawn makes sense or is warranted. There's been a few comparisons made about whether it actually looks better or just different. I think that the one interesting thing here is that, yes, it'll launch on PC. So the complete edition for Horizon Zero Dawn released on PC in 2020, the remastered edition will launch this year, but will require a PlayStation account to play, where the original version doesn't. So that's weird to me. Is that it'll be two versions of the game if they don't shut down or stop selling the complete version, where it's a single player game. There's a version on PC that already looks very nice that doesn't require an additional login, but the remastered edition will. And just seems like
apparently like they like doubled the price on of the original version after the remastered version was announced too.
Really?
Because you could buy the original for a very cheap upgrade. So it's like $10, was it, if you had owned the game before? And it's like, oh, $10.
If you own the game, you can get a $10 upgrade to the.
So they just stealthily like raised the MSRP of the original after the remastered was announced because of that.
I played the original. I thought the graphics are already insane enough. It's like, I feel like this is like the most pointless remaster in existence. And I actually even think that the original looks better in certain parts, right? So I don't know.
Yeah, cause like the remastered version, like they touted, has like 10 hours of recorded dialogue or re-recorded dialogue, and like improved animation on the models and lighting textures, you know, and sounds, and then you know it'll support like frame gen technologies like DLSS and FSR, and all those sorts of stuff. Brian, you've played these games fully. Does this remastered thing speak to you at all as someone who's already played through them?
The thing is that Horizon Zero Dawn, I won't say famously, but obviously one big difference here is that the remastered version is being developed by Nixxes, N-I-X-X-E-S, which was acquired by Sony last couple of years, where the original version was Virtuos, I believe. And when I played Horizon Zero Dawn on PC, I had no issues with it. Like, it ran decently well for me, and I could get, like, you know, 4K resolution, 60 frames. But then as soon as it released, it had a lot of people reporting problems. And I remember Durante actually put a blog post, said, here are the settings you should set to get the best performance of Horizon Zero Dawn on a PC. And they're all the settings that I'd already been doing. Like, oh, of course I had no issues. I was just lucked into kind of having the appropriate setup, I suppose. Plus, I probably had a PC that was just brute forcing it in a lot of cases. So I guess to try to be a little bit more positive on a remaster, Nixxes maybe has got a little bit more experience under their belt and will hopefully release the PC version in a better state. But then with a trade-off of at the cost of requiring a PlayStation account in order to play it. Like, that's always kind of the other shoe.
Have you seen that Ragnarok on, or that, was it the God of War Ragnarok that has that same thing, and somebody put a mod to get rid of the PlayStation login, but it got removed immediately or something like that?
Well, I mean, so the thing about that is, like, the person who put it up, like, voluntarily decided to take it off after, like, a few hours or a day or whatever, because they don't want to get in trouble by Sony.
Yeah.
So, by already releasing it, like, you know, people are able to spread it, like, you know, within their own circles, you know, under the hood, so to speak.
Yeah.
So, like, but I refuse to buy this game if I had to do a PlayStation login. Even though I have a PlayStation, I'll just get on the PlayStation.
That's the whole initiative. Like Sony budged on Helldivers 2, but that's like the only one time they'll do it. Because that game did not launch initially with that requirement, while all of these are from the get-go, and they're being explicit and transparent up front that you will need to have a login to play them. So it's not like a Helldivers 2 situation where, like, it was more stealthily executed, so like that's why they budged on it, because like they didn't convey well enough that you needed one eventually, while this one they're very 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 obvious and explicit on their pages that you do need it to play the game, which is that's something that like I don't like, but that's all, but also something that like I'm not gonna, like, you know, strike them down for, in terms of like they're conveying it very obviously up front. So if you're getting it and you don't like that, you're still buying the product and then complaining about something that they already conveyed to you up front very obviously. Unlike with Helldivers 2, a lot of people didn't know that eventually you would need a login to play, to have access and play that game, and that's why they walked it back, because that was something that not a lot of people saw, and they disabled temporarily because the servers were being overloaded. That's a very different situation than.
Yeah, that's kind of the caveat. Like, if Sony said, "Hey, we're releasing this new title. It's coming to PC either at the same time or later," and we want you to sign into it. Like, sure, it's annoying, but I get it. But then, like, Helldivers, you didn't have it required. Horizon for Zero Dawn, there's a version of PC that doesn't require it. I just looked it up because I hadn't gotten to it yet. Horizon Forbidden West released on PC this March, like 6 months ago, and doesn't require it. And it just seems that's I think what's causing the irrationality, not irrationality, just irritation, is that it just doesn't seem consistent. It's like, why this, not this? Why this later, but this now?
It's one of those things because Sony shifted their strategy to like said because thanks to like primarily driven by Helldivers 2, they know that they have a substantial opportunity on the PC market to for people to buy their games and get into that Sony ecosystem. So because they want their metrics, they're making the PSN login mandatory because they want people in that ecosystem to drive up their numbers for their metrics and their hope. And they've stated themselves in their fiscal report, their hope is like to convert those people who bought it on PC for them to get like the sequels on PlayStation. Like, man, I really want like the sequel to Ghost of Tsushima, for Ghost of Yote, I really like Tsushima on PC, so maybe I'll get a PS5 to go play Yote when it releases. That's like their ideal strategy. Like Tsushima, when it came out on PC, that's kind of like one of the earliest releases this year that mandated that PSN login.
Yeah, it does. Yeah,
as well. So that's their business strategy. Whether it's a smart one or not, I don't really think it's a great strategy, but in that line of thinking, but that is what their strategy is. That's why they will not budge for that PSN login requirement anymore, because it was a very much a one-time miraculous stars aligned situation for them to double back on the Helldivers 2. But that's not to say that they're permanently gonna like disable it for the Helldivers 2. I'm sure they're working around the clock to be like, okay, how can we get Helldivers 2 players into the ecosystem without getting so much backlash like last time? It's a complex situation, but I mean, at this point, people who are complaining are just like, it'll die down eventually. It's like how every other fucking backlash for other logins, like the EA login, for the Ubisoft login, eventually died down over time on Steam to sign onto those services. They're still annoying as fuck, but people don't really cause a stir about them anymore because it's been so long.
It's the internet. People forget about things.
It's
after
a vocal
a year.
Minority. Yeah.
So that's how it is.
Let's have a few more dates to wrap up through here. Fantasian Neo Dimension, of course, this is the console release and PC release for Fantasian that was announced back in the summer. We'll be releasing on December 5th. And it looks like James did just put up a hands-on preview for Fantasian Neo Dimension, specifically on Steam Deck. Of course, originally a mobile game. Kind of no surprise that it seems like it's at home on Steam Deck, only with the new voiceover and things like that for that version of the game. But yeah, if you haven't played Fantasian because you didn't want to, get into Apple Arcade's ecosystem or play on mobile, it'll be coming out at the end of the year for consoles and PC. Going into next year, some early Q1 release dates. Wizardry, The Five Ordeals, which released on PC a couple years back, will be releasing on Nintendo Switch on January 25th. Phantom Brave, The Lost Hero, of course, was announced, I believe, at a Nintendo Direct in June, is going to be releasing for all consoles on January 30th. And the PC version will also launch in 2025, but later. So January 30th for consoles, PlayStation and Switch, and then PC in 2025 at some later date. The Utaro Romono trilogy, this is Prelude to the Fallen, Mask of Deception, and Mask of Truth, will all release on Nintendo Switch in Japan next year. No announcement yet of a Western port, but seemingly likely if they're going to be bringing them over to Switch, that we'll eventually see them in English, but nothing confirmed at this point. Here's probably the most interesting one out of the list near the end here, and kind of ties into the previous discussion a little bit. Assassin's Creed Shadows was originally slated to release on November 15th. It has been postponed, and Ubisoft will release Assassin's Creed Shadows on February 14th of next year. In addition, it will be launching on Steam as well as the Ubisoft and Epic Games Store at launch. So it'll be available on all those PC platforms on February 14th next year.
Yeah, and then according to that, like, you know, the stated reason on their Twitter post was to pause and refine the experience, pushing further some of our key features. Some of the and also, like, one of the big change-ups to this is, along with this delay announcement, they canceled all previous pre-orders, because all new pre-orders henceforth that delay will have all the pre-orders, new pre-orders will have the first expansion given to them for free to all the people who pre-ordered. Unlike the, gating that off the season pass model that they previously have done for their previous releases. So they're shifting to a new model where they're kind of getting rid of that season pass model and, like, kind of being more, I guess, you know, they want to allow players to, like, you know, keep on playing the game well after its release, and the step for this for Assassin's Creed Shadows is making that first expansion for free, so more people are incentivized to come back to it because they've got that content for free, and so forth.
I mean, in a
So.
vacuum, I kind of like that. It's maybe not my preference, but I'd rather say, hey, for those that pre-order, instead of getting a free costume, you get the first chunk from the season pass, rather than having to pay for the season pass up front in like some $120 mega edition. Though I'm sure that's still an option. Of course, there'll be future DLC that they're hoping to get you into. Like, hey, we'll give you the first one, but then if you want the other two, you got to get the season pass. So I, you know, it's calculated in that way, but I still do appreciate it on its face.
Yeah, so hopefully the game, like, the there was more to this report because Ubisoft, you know, released a statement, and there are some memos that were leaked, and also, like, based on their, like, financial report and so forth. But the basic summary is, like, Star Wars Outlaws didn't sell as well as they hoped. They call it was a soft, softer than they expected its sales performance, and they're hoping that to get more people back into the game, or get new players into the game via bug fixes, fixing checkpoints, fixing, you know, the AI in the game, like the behavior of NPCs, and having, you know, sales discounts like around Black Friday and so forth, because apparently that game didn't really miss the mark, let's just say. Of
Well,
what
and
they were
also
hoping
getting
to
like the
get.
Star Wars license extremely expensive. If your game doesn't perform, you're basically screwed.
Yeah. And also, like, you know, I don't think that'll really drive sales for that game, but no, what do I know? I mean, Ubisoft has already been facing, like, they've been struggling for a long while
Yeah,
for
I think
various
they're really
reasons.
banking on this game. If this game does not perform, they're basically gone.
Yeah, and they are, it's kind of weird that they, like, based on the memos and the financial report, that, like, they were already planning to ship Assassin's Creed Shadows, knowing, you know, that this game had, had performance issues and bugs, like for that November launch. But now they're like, okay, we really want to take the time to really polish that out. So it's like it was already a previously calculated move for them to ship this in a maybe subpar state performance-wise, and fixing it up later, and maybe, you know, that's maybe kind of their strategy before, and hopefully moving forward, that's not the strategy. It should never be a fucking key pillar to be like, we're gonna release this game in maybe a not great state, and then we'll fix it later. Maybe that's not a great philosophy.
That's a terrible
Let's say, I'm
mindset.
just saying, that's not a great philosophy. Yeah. So, you know, we'll see how it does. I mean, February is a pretty crowded, it's a crowded release day, crowded month for releases. So, I don't know. I don't know. Best of luck, but, you know, there's a lot of factors working against Assassin's Creed Shadows, and a good portion of that is because Ubisoft has been losing a lot of goodwill, and I think a lot of people have just been kind of getting tired of Ubisoft's antics, let's just say, throughout the past few years. And it's really, really, really biting them in the ass now.
So
But
I
you
was
know.
looking at other Ubisoft games, because obviously there's also that footnote about it coming to Steam right away. Clearly their experiment to have a try to get people into the Ubisoft launcher or get the kickback from Epic and then come back to Steam has just not worked. So they're getting it on Steam at the outset. Like Skull and Bones was another one that released on Steam kind of late. I had to remind myself that game released at all. And this is not indicative of anything, but just the Skull and Bones has got a mixed review on Steam. But I found the apparently during the process of coming over to Steam, it changed its app ID. So there's one right. You can still access the old. The old discussions, but it's called Skull and Bones, old, do not use. Just like, nice. Okay, like awesome. That's just literally what the title of the game on the Steam app is called now. You can only get to it if you search for it, but that is kind of fun. Cool. But yeah, just like long projects like Skull and Bones, like Beyond Good and Evil 2, which I suppose they're still working on, I guess. And then like there's small projects like that Prince of Persia game that was critically well-received, just still didn't set the world on fire. So Ubisoft's kind of in, I won't say dire straits, but just kind of in a tough place where they're big games like Avatar. And of course, like we said, Star Wars haven't set the world on fire. Their smaller games that they've kind of returned to with that Prince of Persia title have done well, but still aren't hitting their bottom line. So they're banking
I don't know if I call it done well for even that Prince of Persia game, because it was received critically well. But
I guess that's what I meant. Yeah, I guess that's what I meant. Critically well, not necessarily commercially well.
That was also a late release on Steam, and it's like this probably would have done way better if like they'd released simultaneously on Steam. You know, that game is unfortunate, because that game, like The Lost Crown, is like legitimately fantastic, but it's mired by like a lot of people just losing a lot of goodwill for Ubisoft, and also not launching on Steam simultaneously. You know, so Steam is a substantial market. It's difficult to ignore the Steam player base. Just unfortunate, you know, all around for that game. So we'll see what happens. Hopefully Assassin's Creed Shadows is a great game and launches in a good state. That's all you can really hope for. But Ubisoft has just fucking fumbled the bag so many fucking times because of their business practices. Can you really say?
And then one last 2025 release window that we have, Momodora, Moonlit Farewell, released on PC earlier this year in January. It will be releasing on PlayStation, Xbox, and Switch in early 2025. We just had a short little tiny announcement from Playsm about the console version for next year. But yeah, that was a lot of news coming out of the State of Play, coming out of TGS, coming out of the Level 5 event. And of course, we're getting into a very busy time of year for releases. So we were able to talk about Zelda this week. Let me look at my release calendar. Next week, we'll have... we do have Starfield Shattered Space, that expansion coming out in a couple of days at time of recording. Maybe I'll try to get around to that. Early October, we've got the Diablo 4 expansion. Of course, Metaphor, October 11th, Romantic Saga, followed by East, followed by Dragon Age. bang in October. And then November, a little bit quieter, but Mario and Luigi followed by Dragon Quest 3. And then early next year, the other Dragon Quest 1 and 2 HD remake. And then February, like Assassin's Creed got moved to February to kind of for polish, but now February all of a sudden is crowded with games like Avowed and Kingdom Come pushed into there, and now we've got Monster Hunter and Like a Dragon just announced to come out in February as well. So
yeah.
Next year is immediately getting pretty packed.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, thank you, Josh. Thank you, Chow. And of course, they're not here, but also Adam and James for holding up the fort of the podcast while I was out. And of course, hopefully, we'll hear back from James. I believe he's slated to be back next week. I'm not sure. I think Adam is out until the week after next, but we'll record with whoever is available to be present for next week's episode of the podcast. If you've listened to this podcast and like it on whatever podcast service of choice, give us a rating, give us a comment, give us a review if you'd like. We do like to read those. Join our Discord, discord.gg/RPGsite, to join the conversation if you're excited about any of these upcoming games. You can follow RPG Site on any of the social media networks. Just search for RPG space site, S-I-T-E, and you should be able to find us. And we'll be back next week with another episode of the TetraCast. So until you hear from us next time, stay safe, take care. We'll talk to y'all later.
All right, peace out, everyone. Stay safe.